Tonight on The Download, from The Daily Show, Hasan Minhaj, Chicago chef Jason Hamill and Matthias Merges, and contemporary music composer Augusta Reed Thomas. And now, here's your host, a man who is wearing three pairs of socks today, Justin Kaufman.
Telling you, Pete, these shoes. Oh, these shoes. I gotta wear three pairs of socks. It's only the beginning of October. If you'd at all been paying attention to my life, I decided to buy a $100 pair of shoes. I know, crazy, right? And I thank the Download Nation for telling me about it. When I was complaining about the big hole in the back of my summer shoes, everyone laughed at me. They scoffed at me. They said, it's because you buy $35 pairs of shoes. And there's something to that. So I took their advice, got some advice. Pete gave me some advice as well. I said, I'm going to go buy a $100 pair of shoes. So I went to a great boutique. I think it's DSW. And went for the high end, right? Got them. Love them. I feel like I got my swagger back. It's very like, I feel like I'm just like walking down Michigan Avenue and everybody's checking me out in my new shoes. The problem is that the heel and like the back of the heel, almost where the Achilles is at, it's just like rubs it the wrong way. Full-on blisters, both feet. So Amy Guth, great Amy Guth, who's Saturday Night Special here on Saturday, the Business Lunch on Saturday, she said her grandmother told her bandage and wool socks to break in new shoes. So you got to wear wool socks. So I don't really have any wool. I have a pair, so they go out. So I'm like, well, it's got it. So I tried like one pair of socks, like a little thicker, and I still had the problem. Tried two pairs of socks, didn't really work out. I am up to three pairs of socks. With these shoes,
how can you fit in the shoe?
It fits barely, and it's tight. I mean, it's weird. It's very snug.
Because now, when you go back to one pair of socks, the leather is all going to be stretched out. You're going to be flopping around in there.
This was a disaster.
Did you try my
what was
tip?
Yours? Duct tape?
No, a lift. Get a little insole.
Yeah, I tried that. It didn't work.
It wasn't like it over
yeah,
the spot
now,
where
now
it rubs.
It stayed. It's still rubbed, and now I was in danger of the shoe not fitting.
I see.
So then I took that out. But you know what? I have to say, today with the three pairs of socks, no rubbing. Hot feet, but no rubbing, right?
Well, it's going to be cold. I mean, it's 80 degrees today, so a little, little tough with the wool socks.
And you know what? Tomorrow, maybe I'll go to two pair. You know? Maybe we'll go to a thicker sock by the end of the week. By next week, we'll be good to go. Or I throw these in the garbage, and I go get myself a $20 pair of shoes.
And these aren't your winter ones, are
no,
they?
No, these are like the cool fall ones.
Right. So you're gonna in another month you're gonna have to break in.
Yeah, those are different. Those are like more like boots. So there isn't that like rub issue.
But lip.
You know what? It is what it is. Welcome to the Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on 720 WGN with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We have a jam-packed show. Obviously, we weren't on last night. So Blackhawks destroyed the Detroit Red Wings preseason action. Pete and I were at the game. As long as with a lot of the WGN family. But so tonight, I feel like this is going to be all winter long. We just can't help ourselves. We jammed so many segments into tonight. We have 10 guests. I counted it up. 10 guests for you tonight. It's an eclectic show for you, Download Nation. I'm excited. I'll go through it real quick, and then we'll get with the show. Chicago, big stuff about Chicago police today. Obviously, a new ordinance, a new agency to sort of be the civilian oversight. We'll wonder if that's going to work. But more importantly, there's an article in the Breeder this week about a Chicago police secret budget. Essentially, it all exists around forfeitures, taking, seizing cars and other pieces of property from people who are arrested and convicted. But where does that money go when the police actually get your car and you go to jail? And they sell your car, you're supposed to put that into a budget line. The Chicago Police Department keeps it secret. What are they doing with the money? We'll find out. Chicago Reader did a great investigation, which City Council was talking about this week. We'll also talk about affordable housing here in Chicago and Uptown specifically. Homeless sweeps coming through this week. Protests, angry protests. There were some arrests in front of Alderman James Kappelman's office, the 46th Ward up in Uptown. We'll talk with Alderman Kappelman about that coming up a little bit later. Also about the initiative, hashtag Chicago Proud. Hasan Minhaj from The Daily Show joins us to talk about his upcoming show, Italia Hall. Pilot Light, the great Pilot Light, I guess you'd call it a chef. It's an organization that benefits the idea of more food education and awareness in schools. Jason Hamill and Matthias Merges, two of the chefs that founded the organization, are going to join me. Jason from Lula Cafe, Matthias from You Show A10, all sorts of stuff. I mean, this is going to be great to have those two both at the big table. We'll talk body positive. We're going to do a little fashion tonight. Curvologist Carmen Rivera is going to be here. We will talk about some of the issues that are playing out in the presidential campaign. You'd wish there'd be better issues than body shaming, but that's where we're at. So we'll talk with Carmen about that. Also, contemporary music, the Ear Taxi Festival. Augusta Reed Thomas, the Grammy Award-winning composer, who's also at the University of Chicago. She will join us tonight. So much to do tonight. I feel like I probably missed like four segments that we're doing, but that's okay because we're here all night. We will catch up news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by my man Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's get the show on the road. It's Download here at 720 WGN. Let's start with the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The City Council approved Mayor Emanuel's new police oversight agency. The vote was 39-8 to replace the existing agency, IPRA, with the new agency. The only problem with the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, COPA, at the COPA, Copacabana, is that there's no civilians involved. Critics say that the mayor missed the mark with providing more transparency, and this is just like the existing agency, down to the same woman heading it up. But hold up, that's because that's the next ordinance that will be passed. Seriously, that's what the city said. This is just one step, but the stuff about transparency and actually having civilians on the board, next time. Sure. What's that sound? You hear that? It's like a tinny. It's like someone's kicking a rusty can, like down the road. You hear that? No? I do. The question is whether or not this new agency is enough to appease both police and community who are looking for a better solution on how City Hall investigates police. We shall see. Schools and other community agencies are making contingency plans for next week's impending strike. Not looking good, Chicago. A teacher strike is set for October 11th, which would be next Tuesday. At first, I thought this was like Bluff City, like we were watching bad poker on ESPN. But no movement, and we're getting closer. So get ready for Take Your Kid to Work Week. 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Take your kids to work for a month. There's some talk that the city's looking into finally raiding the TIF funds, but my guess is they'll somehow screw that up. So, also, where's Springfield on this issue? Oh, that's right. They're not at work. It's summer somewhere, right? Instead of tending to budgets and trying to fend off a labor strike, they're putting up yard signs and producing documentaries. Killing it, as always, Springfield. A new study ranks the top 25 municipalities with the worst violence, and you know what? Chicago didn't make the list. The closest was Springfield. And that's probably just lawmakers alone, really. Now, the study uses data from 2015, but we're not that far off from 2015 numbers. And these studies are about violence per capita, and Chicago's so big that we don't register. So not saying it's not an issue, because it is a big issue. But maybe cool it on the old Chicago, Chicago, Chicago at the next presidential debate. I know Rockford, Rockford, Rockford doesn't roll off the tongue as well, but still. The jury's in, and Governor Mike Pence won the VP debate last night. But after the fact, many observers fact-checked the governor, who may have told one or two or 20 lies during the debate. But you know what? That's typical mainstream media. Always falling back on facts instead of feelings. Feelings win elections. Feelings are like ice cream. Facts, they're like hot fudge. You don't need the hot fudge. Sometimes you just want the mint chocolate chip. It's just weighing you down. Wait, what are we talking about again? Lost my train of thought there. In weather, it's hot again. Make up your mind, weather gods. You're worse than an Ohio voter. But really, in weather news, Hurricane Matthew hitting Florida soon. In sports, the Cubs will find out who they play after tonight's wild card game between the Giants and Mets. Hopefully, they go into extra innings and use every one of their pitchers, and they all get Tommy John, which is essentially what happened to the Blue Jays last night. The Cubs are ready, though. Wrigley's been polished. They spray-painted the field. They swept the concourse. Maybe wiped down the condiment stand. Probably not enough time. But the starting pitchers are going to be Lester, Hendricks, Arrieta, and Antonio Alfonseca. Nope, sorry, read that wrong. John Lackey. Sir John Lackey will be the fourth guy. If you go by their nicknames, it's Bald Eagle, The Calculator, Iceman, and Big Country. So good. We did so good. The Bears got some more bad news this week. Wide receiver Kevin White fractured a fibula, and he is on injured reserve. He may be able to come back, but that's just John Fox's way of saying he's out for the year. Not a great start for Kevin White in Chicago. Missed all of last year, now this year. Who else has had this much bad luck at the start of their Bears career? Chris Williams? Mark Colombo? Gabe Kareemi? Kevin White? Ugh, God. The Bears are now without their starting quarterback, running back, wide receiver, center, nose tackle, outside linebacker, inside linebacker, and cornerback. No word on whether or not mascot Staley has recovered from his hamstring injury. Not to be outdone, the Bulls have played one preseason game, and their prized rookie Denzel Valentine, greatest name, by the way, sprained his ankle, and he's out the remainder of the preseason. But, man, he looked good in summer league. What else? Did the Sky win last night? Let me look that up. WNBA scores, Sky, Chicago, basketball, baby blue, yellow, still nothing. But you know what? They lost. So if you're keeping score, that means the end of the year for the WNBA season here in Chicago. And finally tonight, Robert Feeder reported today that our boss, Jimmy DiCastro, is stepping down from his post as general manager here at WGN Radio. You know, it's been an honor to work with Mr. DiCastro. I'm a radio kid from Chicago, and an opportunity to work with a legend like Jimmy, truly a blessing. And as a boss, I've never had so many high fives in my life. Listen, I've been a boss before, and I wasn't good at it. Jimmy, he's good at it. Seriously, he's so good that he'd be able to take this injured, talent-deficient Bears team to 8 wins, just on enthusiasm and motivation alone. And that goes a long way when you're pouring your heart and soul into a microphone, not sure what's happening on the other side. But Jimmy knows, and Jimmy's there for you. Jimmy will be missed, but it ain't goodbye. It's just so long for now. Well, that's the carryout for October 5th, 2016. Hey, we found some old hot dogs from the summer in the back of the fridge. And since the weather got nice again, why don't we just make that the special? You're welcome, Chicago. And while we're doing that, Jimmy DiCastro comes by the window and waves hello. That's the kind of boss he is. That's amazing. All right, more to come. A lot to come on the show tonight. We'll talk about a secret police budget. And anyway, we're going to talk about it. There's a lot to talk about with the Chicago readers in the house. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Mr. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well, my friend, and you?
I'm doing good. It was good to be out at the stadium yesterday at the UC.
I heard.
Hawks.
Yeah. I was here hanging on every word that Tim Kaine and Mike Pence put
Someone
out.
Had to be, right? Someone had to be.
I lied. I was watching the game.
So no. But it was. I thought about you. Pete and I thought about you. We're like, oh, man, Martier's got to be here. He can show us what's happening.
I felt the disturbance in the force. It was good.
That's good.
Yeah, they looked well. I mean, you know what? Judd said it to Troy Murray after the game right here on 720 WGN that the Blackhawks are going to have some tough decisions to make before the beginning of the season.
Really? Like cutdowns? Yeah. The same kind of
cutdowns, and there are about two or three guys off the top of my head that I think could probably stick with this team. So we'll see what happens.
Well, that's coming up. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, Mike Fouché usually joins us on Wednesday night. He's got the week off. He'll be back next Wednesday. We'll have to see if maybe we can get him on Tuesday, Pete, just because the strike is supposed to be Tuesday. Lots going on today at City Council. Obviously, a new police agency was approved. Not sure what that means because the city, as I said in the carryout, says there's a third. We still got some work to do. Still got more to do with transparency. With all the talk about transparency and police investigations, the Chicago Reader's cover story this week has to do with transparency in budgets. The story's called Inside the Chicago Police Department's Secret Budget. Every year, police take millions of dollars from ordinary Chicagoans and spend it behind closed doors. It's a story about seizures and forfeitures. You get arrested while you're in your car, and the police impound the said car. Then they tell you they want to keep it. And that car is now the property of the police, who sell it, split the profits with other agencies. But where does the money go? And how is it spent? That's what this investigation looks into. It's really a story about a practice that's been used in police departments and state's attorney's offices for years. But in some states, it's finally coming to an end, or at least reforming. but not here in Illinois. Not yet. Joining me in studio are members of Chicago Reader's Story, one of the co-writers, Freddie Martinez. He's the director of the Lucy Parsons Lab, and Chicago Reader deputy editor Robin Amer. Thanks for being here, you guys. And good to see you again, Robin.
Thank
We've
you,
worked
Justin.
Together for a long time. All right, so let's talk about this. Where does this story come from? Freddie, why don't we start with you? I mean, what piqued your interest in finding out about a secret budget?
Sure. So I started investigating a separate surveillance issue. I started investigating stingrays or MC catchers, these surveillance devices that capture information about people in a general area. And I noticed that there was money coming out of this thing called the 1505, which I was like, what is that? So like any journalist would do, I started sending Freedom of Information Act requests. I started asking questions, and it turns out that it comes from this practice called civil asset forfeiture, which is exactly what you described. You get arrested or something like that, the police will take your car or your money, and then they'll move through this process called civil asset forfeiture, where you'll get a letter in the mail, and they'll say, we want to keep this cash, we want to keep your car. And then I was like, well, what is that? How big is the budget? How much money are you taking? Where is it going? And that was about a year ago, and so we've been following this for quite some time.
It's an amazing story, Robin, and it's one that, I mean, reading it, it's hard to believe, because really it's about the lack of transparency. This forfeiture, seizure,
civil asset forfeiture.
Civil asset forfeiture. That's not new in the sense that if you get arrested and convicted, they take your car and they take your property if it was involved in the crime. But this is about where that money is actually going and why it's secretive. I mean, the Chicago police are not telling us where that money's at.
Absolutely, Justin. That is the big picture here. If you take a step back and you think about it, you know, every year the city goes through a public budgeting process, right? The mayor proposes a budget to the city council. The city council vets it. They have department commissioners come and testify about why they need the money that they say they need. And then they pass a budget. And in last year's public budget, the Chicago Police Department was given an astounding $1.45 billion, right? They get more money than any other city agency.
Because the schools are a different agency.
Right, because schools are technically separate, as is like the Parks Department. But we found essentially what I would describe as a secret slush fund, money that is in the control of the police department, that is not vetted by the city council, that is not vetted by the mayor, in fact, which is subject to no public oversight or transparency of any kind, right? So if the police department says, I want to spend money from the slush fund, they only need internal approval, right? Not even approval from the superintendent, just approval from like
from a
division commander, a division chief. So it absolutely starts with oversight. And I think, you know, we can go into the numbers as far as what we found, like how much they spent. But that's the big picture is,
it's millions of dollars.
Tens of millions of dollars. So we went as far back as 2009, which is the year that the police department started keeping electronic records. So it was just easier for them to provide us with documents and easier for us to get them. And we started with the question of, okay, well, we know that there are these bank accounts that are tied to civil forfeiture. So let's find out how much is in those bank accounts. And we obtained essentially like ledgers that showed us how much money was in those bank accounts. And we found that over the last 7 years, sorry, since 2009, that police have essentially seized and forfeited more than $72 million. Wow. And they haven't kept all of that money. They have to divide that money between
themselves,
the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, and the Illinois State Police.
But this is what I find interesting, especially when it comes to the State's Attorney's Office, and it's in the story, which you can find at ChicagoReader.com. The concept that the State's Attorney's Office will line item budget this. They put it in saying this is where we get the money, and that's public. It's really about the idea that this practice is secretive, because for me, the bigger picture that I take from this article is this concept of almost like for-profit policing, where they can, you know, and you use one subject in the article that it's kind of a gray area whether or not she should get her car back. She wants her car. She wasn't convicted. Her son was convicted. There's a lot going in, and you start to realize as you peel back that, you know, the train has left the station on that one. But that's what it really the idea of keeping a secret budget means. Do you bring up issues like not only what they're using it for, but you know, are they essentially using the illegally or, you know, in a gray area for seizing and using forfeiture to fund a slush fund?
Absolutely. So if you just take the phrase for-profit policing, maybe we should just break down for people what we mean by that. So again, the police department is the agency that takes this stuff, right? They arrest you, they take your cash. They're also the agency that gets to spend that money that they decide to keep. So, lack of oversight, lack of transparency, plus they get to decide what to do with the money. So one of the people we talked to for this story used the phrase the sword and the purse, right? The police have both the sword and the purse. They have the power to take the money, and then they have the power to spend the money, which if you're concerned about, but the potential for misconduct or abuse of power, it raises some red flags right there. Right.
Freddie, exactly. Let me ask you, from your reporting, what are they spending it on?
So this is my concern, just as going through this investigation, was a lot of it was things that you would think would be in a budget. So for example, we've got almost $100,000 a month being spent on enterprise, what they call fleet services.
This is car rentals, right? Rent cars from enterprise.
Right, exactly. Okay. Think that would be a thing that they would put in a budget. There are also squad cars. There are also undercover cell phones that they would equip for, undercover police officers. Things that are very much in the everyday war on
drugs. You would expect to see in a public
budget.
They're
like routine day-to-day expenses, basically.
Right. So that can cause red flags, right? Because if you're thinking that you're paying for the war on drugs through money that you seize from people through the war on drugs, you see how it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. So that's a big thing. That was the majority of what we found. There's also this surveillance budget, which is where a lot of, like, for example, the blue light cameras that you would see across Chicago, that money comes from this fund. Then there's also like automatic license plate readers, which will scan your car as you're going through the city and record that.
Not to mention the stingrays, which we started the conversation about.
Correct.
And that's being able to crack cell phones in any area. Tell me what that is.
Yeah. So the stingrays, that's a kind of a generic name. So what they do is they will broadcast as a fake cell phone tower and gather information of everyone in a given region. And that could be tens of people, hundreds of people in a city like downtown Chicago, that's thousands of people. And that gathers all kinds of identifying information. Also things like who you're calling, how long those calls last. Very kind of revealing details about, if I'm calling like maybe my doctor, that's very revealing. And so that's where we started. And then that's what we found, that 9% or about 10% of the budget goes to surveillance budget.
And we should say that, we calculated based on literally hundreds of FOIA documents that the police kept about $47 million through forfeiture, of which they spent about $36 million. And we didn't analyze all of their purchases. We only analyzed purchases greater than $5,000 because we figured those would be the most interesting. So we should say that of these larger purchases that are known, right, because we did get some redacted documents back where they were like, we're not going to tell you what we spent this amount of money on. So of the known larger purchases, like 90% were routine expenses and 10% were these surveillance related expenses, which again is significant because this is a secret budget. There is no oversight. There is no accountability. There's no requirement that they disclose these purchases to the public. So you have the police buying controversial surveillance equipment that they are using to spy on Chicagoans without having to disclose those purchases.
Because it's controversial, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And they say in their documents, it's amazing. They literally say in these FOIA documents, which you can see on our website, this is a secret. Don't tell people that we are buying this.
Right, exactly.
Freddie Martinez is the director of the Lucy Parsons Lab, Chicago Reader, deputy editor Robin Amer, also in studio. The story is at thechicagoreader.com. We've just got a couple minutes left. What I really love about the story is this is a practice that American police departments from all over, from different states, have been routine. But there has been a crackdown. There has been some changes. It's essentially when you hear the buzzwords police reform, a lot of it is around this concept. You hear states like New Mexico, others who actually passed legislation that said, you know what? You just need to make it in the general. It needs to go to general operating so we know what it is to take away this sword purse concept.
Right. So the reform efforts usually break down along two lines. So again, let's just remind people that this is civil forfeiture, which means the police legally, this is all legal.
It's all legal.
Can keep your assets or keep your money even if you're not convicted of a crime, right? Even if the charges against you are dropped and the courts say there's no merit to these charges, police can legally still keep your stuff. So a lot of states are moving to say, you know what, we want to get rid of civil forfeiture and only have criminal forfeiture.
So if you're convicted, we can take
your stuff. Yeah, so if you're convicted, we can keep your stuff. And if not, we have to give it back by law. That's one. The second type of reform effort is this oversight issue to say, okay, even if we have civil forfeiture and the police can seize and keep your assets, even if you haven't been convicted of a crime, it at least has to go back to the general operating budget so that the same people who are taking the stuff are not allowed to decide how to spend
it. It's pretty simple. Is that something you see happening in Illinois? You talk in the article about the powerful lobby. I mean, there's a powerful lobby that wants to keep this budget secret.
There have been efforts at reform, although they have so far been quashed. It was very interesting last week to see longtime Alderman Ed Burke talking about this story on the floor of the city council. And what was really interesting to me in hearing him and then also the mayor's budget director, Alex Holt, talking about this story was that they didn't say, wow, this is a potentially abusive process. Maybe we should consider reforming the process so that they aren't taking this money in the first place. Their reaction was more, we want to control this money. We want to have the ability to decide how it's spent, which is legit. There should be oversight.
I mean, that is part of the story. I mean, the idea that they want to do that.
Exactly. And one of the things that we mentioned in our story is that the police are not candid to the public about how civil asset forfeiture should work, but they are very candid to each other. So, for example, in the IACP, which is a police chief conference, which was in Chicago last year, one of the things that we document in our story is that they say to each other, like, I want to take all the money I can, and if states want to crack down on this, we should push back on it very heavily.
And to their defense, I mean, that, I mean, if you're going to say civil forfeiture is a thing, that they want that money, and police respond and they say, this is great. The idea of being able to take away assets from drug dealers, from gangbangers, from things of that nature, that's how you win the war on the streets.
But the war on drugs is also losing. You know, this stuff started in like the late 80s. The idea was we're going to take millions of dollars from these high-end Pablo Escobar types. The average seizure, according to the Illinois, the Institute of Justice, is $550. So even by that measure, they're losing, right? So you can make that argument, but without actually analyzing the numbers and investigating this stuff, you know, you can't take this stuff on faith. And that's why it's important to do these investigations.
And you're right, Justin. I mean, the police obviously aren't on the show right now to defend their use of the practice. So I will just tell you what they have said publicly about why they think this practice is an important tool in their arsenal, especially in fighting the war on drugs. What they will say is, we want to dismantle these drug rings. We want to make sure that they don't have money at their disposal. They don't have assets at their disposal. And so we have to do this in order to win this war. But I think, as Freddie rightly pointed out, you know, critics will scrutinize that opinion and say, I'm sorry, that doesn't hold water. Because if you look at people like, for example, Willie Mae Swansea, the 72-year-old woman who we profiled in the story, I mean, the police took her PT Cruiser, which was worth like $1,400. When her son was arrested and accused of distributing like less than 15 grams of heroin. So she owned the car. Her name was on the title. She was never accused of a crime. And yet it was her car that was taken, and she suffered the consequences of her son's actions.
I would say the one thing out of this story, and it's a great story, go check it out at chicagoreader.com, is the fact that this is a secret budget. It's just the idea, if this was public, I don't know if we'd be having this conversation. The story is called Inside the Chicago Police Department's Secret Budget. It's at chicagoreader.com. Freddie Martinez is the director of the Lucy Parsons Lab and Chicago Reader's. Robin Amer is the deputy editor over there. Great to see you guys. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it. Thank you, Justin. All right, coming up, we're going to talk with two great chefs here in Chicago. I'm very excited about this at the big table. I'm surprised we haven't had them on yet, but I'm glad that they're here tonight. Matthias Merges and Jason Hamill, not the fifth starter for the Cubs, the other Jason Hamill, the better Jason Hamill. He doesn't have elbow problems. We're going to talk about Pilot Light, an organization founded by some great Chicago top chefs to empower Chicago's youth to have a more healthy, positive relationship with food. It's coming up at the big table. Thanks, Rob. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up a little bit later in the show, Hasan Minhaj will join us, comedian who is also a correspondent for The Daily Show. He will join us to talk about his show. He's bringing his sort of stand-up slash one-man show to Thalia Hall. Is it Thalia Hall or Thalia Hall?
Thalia Hall.
Thalia. Yeah. Coming up next, is it next week he's coming up? Yeah. So we'll talk with Hasan Minhaj coming up. Also, the Ear Taxi Festival is coming to town. This is the contemporary music festival that is coming through Chicago. Augusta Reed Thomas, the composer, will be Grammy Award-winning composer, will be in studio a little bit later in the show. Well, right now, this Friday night, the fourth annual Feed Your Mind benefit will take place at Morgan Manufacturing in the Fulton Market District. It's a benefit put on by Pilot Light, which is an organization founded by some of the top chefs in Chicago to empower youth to have more healthy, positive relationships with food. This goes from everything from better lunchroom fare to getting food curriculum in the schools at an earlier age so kids understand more about what they eat, hopefully paving a way for a more educated, healthy adult life. Pilot Light is a tremendous organization. It's founded by some of Chicago's most tremendous chefs, like Paul Kahn from Avec and Publican. And my two guests tonight, Jason Hamill is a longtime chef at Lula Cafe in Logan Square. It's been in Logan Square for 17 years. Jason, thanks for being here. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
And also Matthias Merges. He's the man behind A10 and Hyde Park, as well as Billy Sunday and You Show in Logan Square. Matthias, thanks for being here as well.
Super excited.
I'm my guests here at the big table tonight. So let's talk about Pilot Light. You know, it's the fourth annual benefit. What actually drove you guys to start an organization like this?
Well, I think about 7 years ago, Michelle Obama and the Obama administration had a call to action for chefs to go in schools and to get involved with kids. And we went out there, we came back, we had a big meeting, and we were like, well, how do we do this? How do we get access to schools? And I was already at Disney 2 Magnet, where my two daughters go. And I turned to Jason DePaul. I'm like, hey, I'm already in the school. Let's just get in there and do it. Because, as you know, chefs, they want immediate action. It doesn't matter if we have a plan or not. We just, go and get it.
You got to go get it.
Yeah, so we went into the schools and
started chopping onions right away, right?
That's exactly right. We got in front of the kids and, you know, we had all these excited little faces. And we started talking about food and doing demonstrations. And after a while, we realized that we had something there that really made a difference in kids' lives.
When you go in, when you talk about standing in front of kids and talking about food, what is that presentation like?
Well, I mean, one of the things that happened right away with Pilot Light is in those first meetings, you're like, okay, let's do this. Let's get in these schools. And one of the things that we wanted to do was act on our own. You know, chefs are called upon all the time to lend their hand to charitable causes, which we're happy to do with food and drink and hospitality. But in this case, we're like, okay, what can we do ourselves? Like, we want to get our, you know, hands, dirty, helping people, you know, just get in the schools, let's do something. And then, you know, I don't know who it was, but somebody, you know, with this big round table of, you know, 20, 30 chefs that are sitting there talking. And, okay, let's just go in the school. You know, we'll do a demo in the school. We'll show them what we do. And then someone had the idea of like, well, what are they going to be doing that day anyways? Like, maybe we should connect with what's going on in the classroom in that day. That's a great idea. Okay, so you find out what grade 2 is doing, you find out what grade 4 is doing, you figure it out, and then the next thing you know, you're like, okay, how am I going to figure out fractions, or, you know, the magnetic field of the earth, you know, or you know, a history lesson on civil rights movement, and that's what we were faced with, and, you know, all of a sudden, like fish out of water, we're scrambling, trying to figure out how to do it, and that moment is what Pilot Light became.
That's so interesting, too, because you're right. I mean, a chef, usually when you're being charitable, you're going to cook food. You're going to present food, exactly. And you guys are great chefs. Right. You say, here you go. But this is something where you guys had to do a little bit of work. You had to come up with a curriculum that actually matches what the kids are learning in school.
That's exactly right. And I think that it was really a defining moment for us in Pilot Light that we knew that collaboration with the teachers and understanding what it really means to teach and to be engaged with kids, which as chefs we really knew nothing about. And that collaboration really was kind of like the spark that we're to where we are now. And it's just it's a really wonderful thing when it happens. You know, and we also did things where we wanted to make sure that our curriculum and lesson plans wove into the core curriculum. So it helped teachers, you know, realize their own goals as well. So it's been very exciting.
And you know, I kind of mentioned at the top just about, you know, providing this information and sort of playing with the curriculum to, you know, improve a kid's understanding of food. Is that accurate? I mean, is that the concept of getting a better understanding of what they put in their bodies?
Absolutely.
About how food actually works?
I mean, a huge victory for us is if at the end of a lesson or at the end of the year that we're at a school, a kid is more apt to say like, hey, what is that? Where did it come from? How is it made? Is it good for me? Like those questions. And you build those muscles up by, you know, looking at a hot dog, you know, the hot dog is fascinating, you know, if you start thinking about it, like where it came from, like how it sort of connects to cities and cultures in different ways. We've deconstructed the hot dog with fourth graders with great success. And we actually even took this lesson on the Chicago hot dog, which is a fascinating hot dog, right? Across seas, and taught it to kids in schools in Italy on a recent trip with the Sister Cities program. So, when you take a thing like that and you say, like, okay, where did it come from? How is it made? And the kids are asking those questions. It builds critical aptitude, and they can bring that to wherever they're going. You know?
I mean, obviously, there's much made about how kids are eating. And you know, I've volunteered. I think I volunteered at our school where my son goes, and I've done cafeteria duty. It's not pretty. There's a lot that goes into what they're eating, what they're bringing from home, but also what the CPS is putting on the table. I mean, how much do you sort of run into, you know, sort of the way that families present or families do it, you know, bring lunch and, you know, just a bag of Cheetos or how the school is like, this is hot, just eat it. I mean, how much do you guys run into sort of those, I don't know, I want to call it stigmas, but just, you know, the routines of feeding kids lunch at school?
Well, there's definitely challenges, especially within Chicago and CPS. I think that teaching kids and going through the educational process to have them learn about food and learn about health and their own bodies and how it affects, you know, making them the advocates for change. And I think that that's something that we're really focused on is like, let's have the kids through the lesson plans and have a culminating event at the end of the school year where they're the advocates for something that happens within the cafeteria or classroom. I think that we're going to build like a great momentum towards that and hopefully influence what we can with the food service providers, you know, who
we got a long road to go.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, real
little by
you
little.
Know? Yeah.
We've been doing this for 7 years. So we just now kind of like cracked the code, so to speak, mm-hmm. of just the in-room class. And now we're trying to move on from that.
Well, the fourth annual Feed Your Mind benefit will take place at Morgan Manufacturing in the Fulton Market District. It's going to be this Friday. It's a benefit for Pilot Light. Matthias Merges and Jason Hamill in studio with me now. We'll take a break. Let's come back. Let's talk about our own upbringings and how you learned about food. Two award-winning chefs in studio. We'll see.
That's going to be interesting.
Sounds good.
For sure.
Sounds good.
Mom, turn it off.
Stay with us. Talking Pilot Light, great organization here in town. The fourth annual Feed Your Mind benefit is going to take place at Morgan Manufacturing in the Fulton Market District on Friday night. My guests at the big table tonight, Jason Hamill, longtime chef at Lula Cafe in Logan Square, and Matthias Merges, the man behind A10 in Hyde Park, also Billy Sunday and You Show in Logan Square. We'll talk a little bit about your restaurants and the neighborhoods you guys are in a little bit later in the hour. I'm fascinated, you know, as we continue our conversation about just food. And just, I guess the idea of eating healthy, and we were kind of talking about this off air, but the concept of the way that even our grocery stores are set up, that if you want to eat healthy, you got to have money. I mean, you know, you see what's happening with some of the grocery store chains where it's just more money. So how do you get, you know, the system to change to say healthy food is something more than just, you know, going to Whole Foods and paying it out, because a lot of people just can't afford it.
Well, I mean, you know, Pilot is our answer to that. I mean, we got to start young and grow children who care about this in a deep way so that they'll, you know, grow up to be adults who, you know, vote and make decisions and push, you know, boundaries and turn the country around, because it's true. We have a deep and unsettling problem with our relationship to our value and our food and the sourcing and everything. But, you know, at the same time, through our program, we're teaching kids to think about food in a critical way, and hopefully they'll find solutions for themselves and their families, because there are solutions out there. I mean, in a base way, yeah, the organic food's more expensive. You know, cooking at home seems more expensive than like a bag of Doritos or whatever, yes. But there are methods and ways of going about it, and things that you can bring back the whole, you know, world of the grandmother who can make stretch a chicken over four days, mm-hmm. Like my grandmother could. So, you know, we talk about that too. We bring in sort of the old ways of doing things, the new ways, and see which is better. So I think our program is kind of an answer to, you know, what the situation we find ourselves in.
Yeah, I think we definitely understand that, you know, Chicago is a massive city, and I think that we know that in certain places in the city, access to food is just not there. And that with teaching children through Pilot Light that they just have the critical thinking. So if the only place that they get food is a 7-Eleven or a gas station in their neighborhood, they can really make an important decision about, I'm going to get the baked chips rather than the Doritos, or I'm going to get the banana that's by the cash register as like another alternative to eat. So we hope that it kind of matriculates down, you know, throughout the city and throughout the demographics.
And you guys have said it. I mean, you kind of want to teach food as and access to healthy food as a civil right.
I mean, that was one, you know, off air we were talking about one of our classes where we did that. We sort of created a debate, you know, should access to healthy food be a civil right, yes or no? And the kids, you know, divided up and argued the point, and they actually mapped out the Chicago access points for grocery stores, you know, convenience stores, farmers markets, restaurants that served, you know, local organic food, et cetera. They had a whole bunch of different maps, and they were able to do cartography and mapping and learn those skills, as well as have a really healthy conversation about access to healthy food. And get kids thinking that way, and you know, hopefully they'll make some important decisions down the line.
Let's talk about your upbringing. I mean, let's talk about. I mean,
okay, let's do
was
that.
There a Pilot Light, you know, for you guys growing up? What kind of diet did you have in your home? Not throwing any parents under the table, but
you first, Chef.
Well, that would be a no. There was no Pilot Light around our house. I have to say that, you know, I hope my mom's not listening, but when we were young, my mom was like a terrible cook. But now she's a great cook. I'll just have to throw that out there. But it was not a good scene. And
what kind of food were you eating?
It was just overcooked liver in a pound of butter with onions, or the cold meatball subs with like soggy bread, and just those kind of things we eat all the time. And you know, it wasn't until my dad bought these Time Life cookbooks, the whole series where it was a different country that we were going through. We're like, oh my God, what is this stuff? Is this food? And then that was actually the start of my career, an interest in food, is that we would, for one of their anniversaries, and I think it was like 10 or 11 years old, we actually cooked something from one of the books, and we were like, oh my God, this is delicious. Like, what are we missing here? And since that time, we just, like, it took off. So.
I'm from an Italian family, on my mother's side. So I have the sort of romantic story of, you know, my grandparents cooked, we ate around a table every night. My grandmother came over and made us breakfast and put us on the bus. My aunt lived down the street. I wouldn't say that the food, you know, my grandparents are still alive. My mm-hmm. grandmother was about to celebrate her 100th birthday, and my grandfather oh, wow. celebrated his last year.
Congrats.
They owned a restaurant in their 60s, a little diner with like four swivel seats. And they, you know, he was a cook, she was the front of the house, and they put it together. I wouldn't say any of the food was, you know, it wasn't gastronomic. It wasn't even necessarily like authentically, deeply Italian. It was very Italian American, but it was made with an immense amount of love. Like even if the food was, you know, mediocre.
I thought you were going to say immense amount of butter.
No, there's very little butter,
really?
Honestly.
Lots of Parmesan cheese.
There was a lot of Parmesan. Yeah, yeah.
I think about, I mean, the Italian families, my wife's family, I mean, they are great when it comes to, like, family dinners and putting yeah. things together. It's tremendous. But the food, I mean, is pasta, sausage. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not mm-hmm. necessarily what you would consider a Pilot Light curriculum piece for,
no,
for
but,
a fourth
you know,
grader, right?
I bring this up a lot because we're about to celebrate Thanksgiving. So my family Thanksgiving, which has been the same since I was a kid, mm-hmm. We get there, it's a big table like any other table. They have antipasto. So they have like prosciutto, provolone, you know, burrata, olives marinated, mushrooms marinated, big loaves of Italian bread with a sausage in the middle of it, marinated peppers, all this stuff. I mean, you could feed on it for 5 days. That gets cleared. And then there's lasagna. I'm not kidding. Lasagna, like a 22-ounce portion of lasagna. Beautiful lasagna, meatballs, Italian sausage. That gets cleared, then the whole turkey dinner comes out. The whole thing. In the 70s, there was a Jell-O course, like as like an intermezzo.
Right, right.
Doing that. And then they brought out the pies and everything. I mean,
I think they call those canapes, don't they, at the beginning?
Well, it was ridiculous.
We're talking with Jason Hamill and Matthias Merges. They're both chefs here in Chicago. The Pilot Light benefit, the fourth annual Feed Your Mind benefit, will take place at the Morgan Manufacturing Building in the Fulton Market District this Friday night. Let's take a quick break. We'll get the new update on tonight's news. When we come back, let's talk about your restaurants. I mean, both of you in Logan Square. Jason, you know, you've been there for 17 years. Matthias, somewhat of a newcomer, but at the same time, you have...
I just follow him around.
Yeah, right. also, the restaurant in Hyde Park on 53rd Street. So we'll talk about the relationship between your restaurants and the neighborhoods that you guys are in. It's The Download. It's The Big Table here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We're talking Pilot Light, the fourth annual Feed Your Mind benefit. It's taking place at the Morgan Manufacturing Building in the Fulton Market District on Friday night. You can get tickets at pilotlightchefs.org. In studio with me, Jason Hamill, longtime chef at Lula Cafe in Logan Square. He's been there for 17 years. Matthias Merges, the man behind A10 in Hyde Park, as well as Billy Sunday and You Show in Logan Square and Hyde Park. And Las Vegas.
That's true.
There's a lot of U-shows in the world. But, you know,
I can't.
You guys are, you know, the founders, along with Paul Kahn and others, for Pilot Light. But, you know, you guys have had such a tremendous contribution to the city of Chicago. And why don't I start the conversation about community and restaurants with you, Jason. I mean, you, 17 years ago in Logan Square. Logan Square is a different place than it is today.
It is. I mean, it's. I've lived there also those, you know, now 20 years. I'm not from Chicago. The first place that I moved, it really took me in as a neighborhood and a community, and the friends that I made the first, you know, months that I was here in Chicago and Logan Square are still friends today. And I just found a real, you know, grounding there immediately. So, you know, it's changed and it continues to change, but I still live across the street from Lula and walk every day and see the same people. It's a real community.
Is it hard for you? What are the challenges to be able to continue to do Lula Cafe and Logan Square as the neighborhood gentrifies? I mean, you'll hear a lot of restaurants, especially ones that, you know, were 17, it's any small business, 17 years, saying, this is, all right, this is, I got to get priced out. I got to go find a different neighborhood to set up.
I mean, the challenge is just, is a business challenge, right? Is that, you know, when you're 17 years going on, you know, there's a lot of infrastructure that, you know, wears out over time and you have to reinvest in a future that's uncertain. And, you know, our industry, you know, even though it seems like it's, you know, doing great, there's restaurants opening every day. You know, it's become one of the new sports. You know, you got football, baseball, hockey, and restaurants, you know. So people are really interested, but as an economic endeavor, it's a challenge. And, you know, I think that it's, you know, a risk to get into the business and to stay in is a, you know, it's a lot of hard work and a lot of perseverance.
For you, I mean, being someone who's been in the neighborhood for 20 years, I mean, do you like the way that Logan Square has developed?
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, hopefully it'll stay like this. But right now, I mean, if you look at the restaurant industry in Logan Square, you have actual chefs with skill, talent, and vision running restaurants. You have Abe Conlin at Fat Rice. You have Johnny and Beverly that, you know, they're up in a little bit in Avondale, but still that counts. You have Honey Butter Fried Chicken. You've got You Show and Billy Sunday. You've got JV at Giant. You've got the Scofflaw guys, like, doing great cocktail work. You know, Paul McGee, you know, at Lost Lake. You know, Jared at Longman and Eagle. There are people, like, in their restaurants working and doing great stuff. And, you know, what neighborhood is like that? You know, it's amazing stuff.
Matthias, what drew you to Logan Square? What was it about the neighborhood and the challenge of being able to open a business in that neighborhood?
Well, we lived there. We had a house in Logan Square for quite some time. And, you know, after I left Charlie Trotter's after 14 years, I was really looking to do a real big change. And, you know, fine dining was, I did it for so long. I was like, I really want to shake it up and, like, really explore kind of other things and do some things in neighborhoods and, you know, give back. And Pilot Light was one of those things that, you know, I first, like, really held on to, and as it blossomed, and I want to do the same thing and give back in communities. And Logan Square was really close to where we lived, and I just liked the dynamic. Like Jason said, the people were great. There was, you know, as far as the real estate was really attractive at the time back 10 years ago. And it was a really great time to look at opening a restaurant.
Well, you said something there about, you know, you wanted to do something in the neighborhoods. What is, talk about the concept of opening a restaurant in a neighborhood as opposed to, say, down here on Michigan Avenue or in a more, I guess, an area that's going to have more foot traffic. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about what are the challenges and what are some of the things you got to think about when you go into a neighborhood.
Well, one thing that myself and my wife, Rachel, and our partner, Brian, one of the things that we really want to do is we want to be able to live in the community and really become intricate in the fabric of the community. So like in Hyde Park, we went down there. We just have a lot of history with Hyde Park and the university, and we always were like, we'd love to come down here and open a restaurant, but you know, it never was right. And a lot of the stars aligned with the university and the city, and this was about 4 or 5 years ago now that we were talking about the deal, and it really started to make sense for us. And we liked the idea of going to a community that's kind of like a little bit unexpected for us, and to really become members of that community and do, you know, more than just what's inside of our box. Because our whole idea is like, you, for a restaurateur, you can't look just inside your restaurant. You have to go beyond that and become members of a community. And mm-hmm. I think it there's definitely challenges when you do that. I think that, you know, you need to run a really tight business because our margins and business are super,
right.
super
Absolutely.
Tight.
The restaurant, of course.
And you really have to get out there and really, you know, make allies. And I think that we've been pretty good at that, you know, through different organizations that we deal with. And
Jason, you talked about the idea of being a neighbor and a part of the community. Does it become more difficult when a neighborhood gentrifies? When you mentioned all the great chefs that come to Logan Square, does it become, I mean, your concept of what your restaurant is and what you want it to be, does it have to change when the neighborhood's dynamics change?
Oh, I mean, I think yes. I mean, there are, you know, standbys, of course, in a neighborhood. But for a restaurant like mine, I feel like it does need to develop over time and change as you change. I feel like, you know, the relationship you have with your restaurant or your project like this is very similar to, you know, any kind of long-term relationship mm-hmm. that, you know, if it's not dynamic, you're in a little bit of trouble. You know, we try to inject change in what we do, and, you know, we revise the dining room, we change the menu. I just got new awnings yesterday. You know what I mean? Like, we do things to make it new. And we connect with people in new ways every week. So, yes, I think it needs to develop. Mm-hmm.
For both of you, I mean, and you know this business very well, but I mean, how much, you know, let's talk about just that root concept, the concept of home, the concept of restaurants having to sort of be identified or be the marker for a neighborhood. A lot of times you see mm-hmm. that in Logan Square. That was the case with Lula yeah. Cafe for mm-hmm. years, that you knew that it was there. Talk about how important that is for you guys as businessmen to actually have an identity with the neighborhood, to be, you know, Lula Cafe in Logan Square, to be A10 in Hyde Park. Mm-hmm.
I think that it's, you know, the basis of like why I am in restaurants, it's that beautiful thing about people gathering around a table to remember who they are, to meet people across the table, to experience something, to really connect with the community that they're in. And as restaurateurs, we provide that kind of experience. We provide that space, and hopefully it's interesting and people like it and they come back, and it becomes kind of like ingrained in the fabric. And I think that that's what we hope we do. So I think it's very important. I think that with today's like social media and everything, it's like so quick. And I think that you need those places of refuge in the city where you can take an hour or two out of your life and like get back to kind of like the roots of who you are and who the person sitting across from you is, and like having a real kind of like soulful experience.
One of the things I think about a lot is, you know, when I moved here, I was in my 20s, I didn't know anybody, and, you know, I was taken in by the industry. And, you know, 17 years, I have, you know, 65, 70 employees. Like, think about the, you know, how many hundreds of people have gone through Lula. And so many of them were in their 20s. They just got out of college. They don't know what they're going to do. They're trying to find their way. They're making friends. Like, they're learning about the world. And, you know, they have ups and downs. You know, we've had marriages, we've had deaths, we've had babies, we've had people like finding themselves in new mm-hmm. ways, and like that community of among the employees, like, I mean, that extends and spills out into the into the clientele too, and there's all sorts of like great things that happen there, and that's an extended family. So to me, that's part of like being in a neighborhood, is building that kind of like connectivity.
We're talking with Jason Hamill, Matthias Merges, both chefs who co-founded Pilot Light with a couple other chefs here in town. The fourth annual Feed Your Mind benefit is taking place at Morgan Manufacturing in the Fulton Market District on Friday night. You can get tickets at pilotlightchefs.org. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. And you know, we'll talk about how the city has changed as a culinary destination. I mean, you guys both have been in the business for a while. You've weathered the storm of this becoming the epicenter of the food world in this country. And we'll talk about if Chicago has what it takes to sustain that and stay at the top.
Oh, it does. It does.
It does. Mm-hmm. All right, we'll continue the conversation here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. This is a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests in studio at the big table tonight, two award-winning chefs. This is great to have you guys here. Jason Hamill and Matthias Merges. Jason Hamill, the longtime owner of Lula Cafe, and Matthias Merges, the man behind A10 in Hyde Park, as well as Billy Sunday and You Show in Logan Square, Hyde Park.
Thanks for having us.
Las Vegas. They are behind the benefit, which is Friday night, the fourth annual Feed Your Mind benefit, which will be at the Morgan Manufacturing Building in the Fulton Market District. Tickets at pilotlightchefs.org. Now, you guys said at the beginning of the show that you have done a lot of charitable work in the sense that, you know, you are called upon to cook
all the time.
Yep. What's the difference between when you're called upon to cook and instead of called upon to organize? As you guys are organizing this benefit.
Well, first of all, we get great chefs because we can call them.
Call in
them,
the favors.
Do the That's favors. What we do. Yep. Hey guys, like let's go. And also the better that group is, the more they bring their A game. It's also extremely well organized, great, it's great alcohol options, we've got great donors and great sponsors. So we bring it and then
great auction packages, by the way.
Are crazy. We call in the favors and ask for some nice stuff.
That's good. All right, both of you guys have been involved with the sort of what's happened here in Chicago in the last, I'd say, two decades, where Chicago's really become the epicenter. We see even the James Beard Awards come to Chicago now. There's just a push to really sort of fortify Chicago as, like I said, the epicenter of the culinary world here in this country. Talk about that. I mean, being a part of the chefs, I mean, Matthias, you at Charlie Trotter for 14 years mm-hmm. of working sort of alongside with him as chef de cuisine. I mean, to think of Chicago that way, I mean, did chefs here at a time think that way? Like back in, I would assume like the 90s, were you thinking that this had that potential to be the epicenter of the food world?
No, we never thought that. So I started back in Chicago in 1987, cooking at Latour in the old Park Hyatt before it was torn down. And it was more about what you did within your space and how good could you make that. And there was no real talk about how awesome Chicago is as a food destination besides the handful of like maybe five restaurants. But over time, and especially in the past, I would say 8-10 years, I think there's such talent here that was unrecognized, and there's been opportunity given to such great young cooks and chefs that you really see Chicago as, like, I think I would have to say, dominating the food scene in America right now.
Jason, what about you? 1999?
Yeah, that was 1999.
So talk about that. I mean, we talked about how the neighborhood was different, but how was, I mean, talk about being a restaurant on the outskirts and did you think?
When we came through a back door, I mean, no one was paying attention to us, so I felt we were in obscurity and didn't care for years. The food world has changed drastically in the last, mm-hmm. 5 years, and in ways that none of us anticipated. And like I was saying earlier, I mean, it's become a sport, it's become entertainment, and, people are eating out a lot. I mean, in order to support every day, new restaurants are opening up in mm-hmm. Chicago, and we're supporting them, and that's what's exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, the city is the kind of place where people come out and support their local businesses, which is, not the case in every city, right? So I think that's one of the reasons why, we're so strong right now. The other reason is there are young chefs doing creative work. You know, I mentioned Abraham and Fat Rice. I mean, that's a creative project. It's beautiful and it's heartfelt. And yeah, it's happening in other cities. But you know, he had he sort of did a DIY thing there and like really went for it. And there's others. There are many others.
But
like
I just I not unlike other industries, whether it be music or or acting. And I mean, there has always been this push to the coasts, where you know, and New York City would be your place you would go for food if you were looking in the 80s, 90s, right? That's where the top chefs shine. Besides the idea of top talent, young talent, what really pushed it that Chicago became sort of a place that people would come to open restaurants? What was it? Was it the like the idea that possibly Chicago started to get better access to what locally grown around the area, ingredients? Talk about, you know, the business climate. What was it that essentially wrestled that industry from the coast?
I think it's, for me, I mean, putting my business hat on, Chicago gave the opportunity for young chefs to have rents or purchase real estate at a pretty reduced rate. You look at New York City right now, it's very, very difficult for a young cook or chef to do anything in that city. And that's why you see only a few like really great players, and they are backed by the angel investors to, you know, you're paying $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $100,000 a month in rent. And in Chicago, you have the opportunity in Logan Square to, you know, back 17 years ago to pay $2,000 a month or $1,600 a month and actually get your feet wet and set up your business so you have an opportunity to understand it and to create your own name and like create your momentum. And I think it's very difficult in the coastal cities. And
still, do you still see that in 2016?
There's opportunity. I mean, they're shrinking the opportunities, but some of the cool restaurants that I've mentioned tonight, they definitely were done with a smaller budget. Smaller budgets means, you know, it's still a risk for those people, and they're putting their life on the line. I mean, look at Parachute. Look at that name, Parachute. That means this is our last chance. If this thing doesn't open up, you know, we're in trouble. And like that kind of like gusto is what, you know, really propels Chicago food scene. I mean, at the same time, I mean, I want to put a shit, you know, like a kudos or props to Charlie Trotter's, because I feel like there's also, we're not in a vacuum here. We have tradition and history in our city, and you know, Trotter's was in my mind like the most important restaurant in America for a long time, and it's very important to me and to many other chefs. And I think that, you know, Alinea is you know, our great fine dining restaurant now, and it's, you know, world renowned, but it is in a history along with Trotter's, you know what I mean, and others. But I mean, Trotter's was the first vegetarian, you know, vegetable tasting menu, if I'm not mistaken, first sous vide cooking, first kitchen table in the table in the kitchen. There are all these like boundaries broken on the high end there, and like the people like Grant now are breaking their own boundaries, plating on a table. That's a descendant of putting the table in the kitchen.
Exactly.
So I think there's tradition here that, you know, should be valued and thought through carefully.
Can't thank you guys enough for coming in and talking food, but also talking food education with Pilot Light. It's great to have you guys. First time on the show. I want to have you guys back, of course. Jason Hamill, Matthias Merges, both co-founders of Pilot Light, the big fourth annual Feed Your Mind benefit will take place at Morgan Manufacturing in the Fulton Market District this Friday night. You can get tickets at pilotlightchefs.org. Jason's restaurant, Lula Cafe in Logan Square, Matthias's restaurant, A10 in Hyde Park, as well as Billy Sunday and You Show in Logan Square, Hyde Park in Vegas.
That's right. Exactly.
You guys, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. Like I said, lots to do in the next 2 hours. Coming up, Augusta Reed Thomas, she's a composer, Grammy Award-winning composer. She's going to be in studio for her new festival, the Ear Taxi Festival. It's a contemporary music festival. It's happening at the Harris Theater down here in Millennium Park, but also all over town, including the University of Chicago's Rockefeller Chapel, where the Carillon-Ur, is that right? Did I get that, Pete? Carillon-Ur? The carillons, the bells at the top of the tower in the Rockefeller Chapel, are actually an instrument, and the carillon-ur is going to play as part of the festival. This is amazing that tomorrow night, they're going to essentially have, you can go out in the park, and they're going to play the bells as a program. I think it's totally cool. That's coming up. We'll talk with Augusta and the Carillon-Ur, Joey, coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour. Also tonight, Hasan Minhaj, the correspondent for The Daily Show, is going to be joining us to talk about his show he's got at Talia Hall coming up on October 8th. Excited to talk to him. He's great. He's been an awesome career both with Jon Stewart and with Trevor Noah, so we'll talk with him. Also, Alderman James Kappelman's coming up. We're going to talk with him and Steve Dale about hashtag Chicago Proud, but also about affordable housing in Uptown, the Uptown neighborhood on the north side of Chicago. Really having an interesting week from sweeping out the homeless tent cities that are along the lakefront there in the park just by the expressway and the viaduct to news that one of the big homeless, I don't know if it's a shelter or if it's a facility, is set to close. And there's talk about this is the beginning of the end for gentrification in Uptown and what happens to the homeless population there. And there's a lot of pressure being put on the alderman, and he's going to be here to talk about that and what the plans are for that neighborhood Uptown on the north side. So lots to do tonight. Let's get to it. One of the byproducts of this year's election cycle, it's very strange. It's very strange to me. We've seen less of an emphasis on social issues like reproductive rights or other social issues that we usually see in politics, and more of an emphasis on the uglier side of society. Racism, talking about sexism, and body shaming. Body shaming is something that continues to circle around the Trump campaign for his words against a former Miss Universe candidate and, of course, comedian Rosie O'Donnell. But it actually goes further than politics. Tim Gunn, the famed host of Project Runway, just made news about a major clothing retailer, like Banana Republic or The Gap, that's the concept, that they're not providing sizes for regular-sized American women, continuing the strange practice of selling to petite women only. Like, if you want anything more than a size 10 at a Gap or Banana Republic, you're not going to find it. And there seems to be more and more forces in fashion that are pushing back on that concept and pushing back against even the mainstream concept that's happening right now around body shaming. It's not a new issue, but it's getting more and more attention. One Chicago woman, though, aims to change that perception with her new boutique in Forest Park called Bliss Fashion Lounge. Her name is Carmen Rivera, and she is in studio with me now. Carmen, good to see you.
Hey, good to see you.
Thanks,
Justin,
to be here. So, thank I mean, you. Let's talk about this. Obviously, I mean, we'll talk about Donald Trump and the concept, but Tim Gunn's, you know, when he goes and speaks, the fashion industry listens, or at least the blogs and people talk about it. And he essentially said, you can't find any sizes for regular sized women in stores like Banana Republic and The Gap. Is he right?
He's absolutely spot on. It's a shame. You go into any store in the mall and there's limited sizing. It's the way it is.
It's always been that way. Why do they do that?
Because the body image has always been smaller. Sizing is what's appealing. And like you said, it's baffling that it's been like that for so long. But now it seems there's attention being paid to the curvier side of things. The curvier girls are becoming acceptable. Not enough yet, but you're starting to see a curve in the trends.
If you will.
Right? Literally.
Well, yeah. I mean, how does that, I mean, you know, when Tim Gunn calls out a Banana Republic or a Gap, for every Banana Republic, you know, hopefully a boutique like yours opens up. But for a curvier woman who is not a size 10 and under, where do you go to find clothes, to find, blouses and dresses and undergarments and that thing?
Well, you're usually going to a specialty store, or I mean, you can go to a department store. You can go to your department stores, your mall stores, and hopefully there's a section with limited styles and options and sizing. But in that respect, they're not usually the same. I mean, you can't just style or size up clothes. You know, you have to kind of make them differently so they fit the form of a curvier girl. With respect to how fashion designers design, they make it for the smaller girls, but then, so you're kind of stuck going to Macy's or your regular department stores, which there's nothing wrong with that, but then you kind of get stuck looking like you're in a tent at some point.
Right. Even the fashion design, and you talk about this in the fashion industry, even at the beginning stages, they're designing clothes for petite, I mean,
exactly.
Skinny women, right?
Yeah, and I hate to say that because, you know, the skinny girls need love too. And if you're under so many sizes, you suffer. But, you know, it's more so for the larger girls because there's just not enough options. You know, and that goes with undergarments and your clothes on top. And it's just like Christian Siriano had his line in Fashion Week this past month, and he had a couple curvy sizes, curvy girls, curvy
fashions.
So
you're seeing
fashions.
More fashion icons moving that way.
So you're seeing it here and there, not enough. They weren't as curvy as I would like them to be, but there were some that were thicker, let's say, thicker than normal. But I'd like to see more girls that do have a gut, girls that have a little bit thicker arms, because some of those girls can't, you know, you can't put your arm through a regular arm sleeve because you are thicker. I mean, it's not just the top or the, you know, the rear. It's all the way, the whole piece of fabric.
Carmen Rivera's in studio with me, the self-proclaimed curvologist. Her Forest Park boutique is called Bliss Fashion Lounge. How did you get into this? What was it that drew you to opening a boutique? I mean, were you in fashion? What drew you to the shop?
Well, I love fashion. I've always been somewhat in fashion, whether it be writing here and there about fashion, going to fashion shows, being involved in some fashion industry in some aspect of it for years now, for over a decade. And I always thought about myself as a curvy girl. I'm not larger than a 10, but at some points in my life, I have been. And during those times, whether it be, you know, after having a child or during pregnancy or what have you, it's always been hard to find something that fits, especially if you're top heavy, we'll say. If you have the larger breasts, it's just difficult because you'll get clothes that are larger in the arms when you don't need that. If you just need something a little larger where you can button it up, they sell extenders and things like that to make it work, but it doesn't look the same. It's not fashioned the same. So it's really difficult for a woman of a curvier figure.
Would you hold it against me that I've never heard the term extender before?
Like,
would you
hold well, I mean, like button extenders, yeah, okay. Bra extenders. So
this,
like,
is a new territory for
the
me.
The buttons don't look stressed, you know, because the girls, you know, they want to come out, but you know, you need something to hold them in, and you don't want it to look weird. But if you buy a size larger, it just doesn't work. It just looks awful.
So you decided to open a boutique that was.
Yeah, I decided to do this after, you know, I was in a career for a long, long time. And I decided I didn't want to do that anymore once it was over and my life needed to take a turn. And I always loved lingerie. I didn't want to do clothes. Clothes have too much dedication. You have to really dedicate yourself to a certain line, certain styles. And I didn't want to do that. It's too much inventory. It's too much work. And I like to work, but with lingerie, my store is fully lingerie, negligees, bras, panties, things like that, body shapers, corsets. But if you want to do something like lingerie, I think it's a little bit easier, not so much in how to size girls, but it's nice to have a woman come in and feel like, you sized me, I feel great, I feel good underneath my clothes, and now I can go forward and find something that fits me that'll look good.
I'm interested in that because, you know, I don't know a lot about women's lingerie. I'm going to be upfront. Pete knows this. That's not something that is in my forte. But I'm interested in the concept of, is the idea the same kind of fashion concepts that we're talking about, this sort of, you know, only sizing smaller? Is that what's happening at places like Victoria's Secret, which I guess would be the Banana Republic of lingerie?
True. Victoria's Secret has dominated the industry for years. Lingerie is I'd say upwards $20, $30 billion a year industry. Women demand it. Women need it. It's a necessity. It's like a shoe. But at the same time, your basics are what rules. I mean, just a comfortable bra, because women are sitting in a bra for 10, 12 hours a day. So men see it as a visual. A lot of people see it as a visual, but you want something that looks good but also feels good. So that's what's becoming more and more important to women. There's a term being tossed around called lingerie athletic, something like that. It's a play on words with lingerie and athletic wear, to where the lingerie is becoming more comfortable because women are demanding, not wanting to flash for their partner or for the audience that they have. They want to feel good.
And that's an issue, I think, you know, when you really think about it. I mean, a bra is something that, I mean, you're wearing for, what, 10-12 hours a day.
At least, if that is
just for show and it's not for support or it doesn't feel good, that's a problem.
It's a big problem. And I've seen women in the restrooms when I was in corporate America, like, pretty much throw them in the garbage after so many hours because they were awful. I had a woman come into my boutique one time and she was almost in tears that her wire broke on her underwire and her bra. And because she was wearing the same bra over and over and over, and not to get too detailed in like how you shouldn't do that, because you should have three in rotation, ladies, always three.
I'm learning so much.
But, you know, I mean, you have your black bra, your nude bra. But anyway, you want to be comfortable. And I hate to keep emphasizing, but your comfort is most important, because then you sit straighter and you become more confident. So your confidence shines through once you're comfortable. So you have to, it's good to look good, but you want to feel good. I know that sounds like just a cliche.
No, it's true. But I mean, I guess for curvier women, or as in your terms, top heavy, I mean, are they finding the same problems that you know, Tim Gunn is talking about when you go to a department store or to a Victoria's Secret where people are not, they're just not sizing for the size that they need?
True. That's absolutely right.
So maybe they force themselves into something that might be more uncomfortable?
Well, they're forcing themselves into something that's not fitted properly for them, and they're being told this is what fits you because that's all they cater to. So something like a Victoria's Secret or whatever, you know, and I don't want to badmouth anyone, but they only go up to a certain size and a certain band size. And some of these girls are a small band and a large cup, or a small cup and a small band, or vice versa, however I said that. But to get fitted properly, you have to have somebody who does it right and knows what they're doing, and then you go from there.
Hmm.
So, and it's all about the comfort of the woman. When somebody comes into my shop, I ask them what they're looking for, if they want wires, or some people don't want wires. Young, old, doesn't matter. Skinny, fat, women want what they want. They know what they want when they walk in that store, which is nice. But then I have some that are totally lost because they've been told you go to this store and this is where they'll take care of you. And that's not the case. And that's the same with the clothes. And Tim Gunn had it right, spot on. It's a travesty that so many women are being told this is what you have to wear. This is how you should look because you're over a size 12. And that's not the case. You shouldn't feel like you have to look like you're wearing a 10. Because you're a size 12 and over. That's ridiculous. So women like Ashley Graham, who are, you know, bursting through boundaries, and I don't mean to say that because she's a thick girl. She's a beautiful girl.
She was the woman that was on Sports Illustrated.
Yes. Right. Gorgeous girl. And I'm so happy she's here because she's a curvy girl. She's beautiful. And she, you know, insists that they don't Photoshop her, or, you know, tweak her photos because that's how she looks. And that's what most of us look like. You know, majority of Americans, I'm sorry, we are a little thicker than most of the people in the world.
Well, when you see a political debate like we saw last week with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and there's talk about, and the subsequent argument on social media about the Miss Universe gaining weight, and then the conversation being about body shaming and fat shaming and everything that went into it, as someone who has opened up a boutique and has worked in this, does it resonate with you, or is it just garbage?
I literally sat there, shook my head, and tweeted right away. I was like, did somebody just body shame in this debate? What was that? I mean, I was mortified by that, because so many women of so many different sizes are watching this, whether they're for or against this candidate. You're listening to this garbage. I mean, that you're going to sit there and talk about a woman's figure or what she looked like or whether she's, you know, too fat now or then or whatever to be walking across the stage. That's humiliating, and that's just degrading to any woman who's over any size. It's just sad.
Carmen Rivera is a curvologist. She owns the boutique Bliss Fashion Lounge in Forest Park, which I don't think of as the epicenter of lingerie boutiques. I'm not going to lie to you when I think of Forest Park, but no, but you're there, so that's great, right?
I am there, and I'm growing fast.
I was going to say, are there other? There's no competition on Harlem.
There's nothing really like me around. There's nothing really that's gives you the service. I look at what I do as a service more than anything. I provide the old-fashioned, and I'm going to say it, the old-fashioned Marshall Fields type of service for the ladies. Like, give the lady what she wants. So she comes in. I'm like that old lady that used to be by the fitting room saying, come here, honey, let me size you properly, like I did when I went to Fields when I was a kid. And that's what I do. I pretty much will hold a lady's hand, put them in the room, and make her feel beautiful again.
Carmen, thanks for being here. The boutique is called Bliss Fashion Lounge, and you can find it in Forest Park. What's the website?
It's www.blissfashionlounge.com. I'm also on Twitter, and I'm also on Facebook and Snapchat. I'm learning the Snapchat. Snap, snap.
Carmen, thanks for being here. Appreciate
Thank you, Justin. Take care.
That was a lot about bras. The 13-year-old in me, I was like, no. It's true. It's as a guy, that's some things you just don't think about. I have to be honest. That's not. I'm a very curious person, and I've spent a lot of time doing segments that I don't know much about, just trying to learn up on. But the world of actually fitting bras, oh yeah, didn't know about that. So there you go. And it totally makes sense. You know, if you go into a Victoria's Secret or any of those places and you're not the right size and they have a size to sell, they're going to be like, oh, honey, that's the one.
Right. Yeah, as a former shoe salesman.
A Foot Locker, you know,
right? Oh, yeah, man. If somebody's toe could be bulging out, you assess the situation. If they're with their mom or something, you know, that might come back. You know, they'll return that, though. But if they're just, you know, a teenager, you know, who won't even bother saying anything about how they hurt.
They're an Ohio State Buckeye fan, but you pushed a Georgetown Hoya
starter jacket. Yeah,
that was my favorite thing about Foot Locker. I've been to Foot Locker in years. Are they still around? Yeah, they're still around.
Yeah,
but like they were always at the top, right? They were like you'd have the shoes, but then if you looked up almost to the top of the ceiling,
mm-hmm.
along the edges, they'd have all the parkas.
Oh yeah.
And she said, "Whatever happened to the Georgetown Hoya parka? I feel like that went out of style. Even sort of the young gangbangers, they don't go with the Georgetown Hoyas anymore.
No,
you never see the Hoyas getting repped on a, you know, accidentally in a gang colors or something like that.
The Raiders. I think they like the Raiders.
Yeah, but I feel like that's the White Sox and the Raiders kind of took that away. But I remember, like, as a kid, I felt like all the cool kids wanted to get the Georgetown Hoyas.
Mm-hmm.
That was like the cool park.
LA Kings when they changed from purple and gold to black and silver.
They, you know, in the movie Straight Outta Compton, they had, you know, all the White Sox gear, those guys. And then someone called it out. If you remember the movie that was last summer, I think. Somebody called it out that the White Sox, that movie's time, there was a continuity problem. The White Sox didn't change their logo till 1994 or so.
Right.
And this was an 80s movie, so they're up on stage with the White Sox, you know, the black and white White Sox, when it should have been the red, white, and blue White Sox. Interesting, huh? Didn't know that, did you, Rob?
A little continuity issue there. Someone's going to lose their job.
Yeah. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this is exciting to have in studio. I think this is the first time we've gotten together. Steve Dale, the man behind Steve Dale Pet World, which you can hear Sunday mornings here on WGN, and also a regular on Cochrane, all the way up and down the aisle. Good to see you.
It's great to see you.
It's great to have you.
It's great to be here. My leash is off, so you never know.
Well, you're here. I'm really excited about this because this is something you're here not to talk about necessarily issues with animals or pets. You're here to talk about Chicago Proud, and this is something that came up today at City Council, and I want to talk to you about that. You've also brought in another guest with us, Alderman James Kappelman. He's the alderman of the 46th Ward here in Chicago Uptown area. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
So before we get to Chicago Proud, if you don't mind, Steve, let's talk. Alderman Kappelman, you've been in the news the last couple of days. Monday night, there was a big protest in front of your office, really about gentrification, about the homeless issue in Uptown. Protesters believe that you and others in Uptown are shrinking the services that are provided to the homeless. What do you say to the protesters who were out Monday night in front of your office?
These protesters were angry about the way the city of Chicago is addressing homelessness, and I agree. they have every right to be angry. I'm angry as well. But there are a lot of good things that we can do to address homelessness, and some things that I, as an alderman who former social workers also doing. I was the one who really pushed for this housing first model of care with wraparound services. And across the country, we now know that is the best practice. That is the way to address homelessness. But these individuals who were protesting in my office Monday night were very angry because they still see lots of homelessness and people living on the streets. And I agree fully. They have every right to be
angry.
And
they've always looked – I mean, people have looked to Uptown as a place that's had numerous shelters, services, and they feel like that's being cut back. The I can't remember the name of the place.
Northside Housing Shelter.
The just recent sweep of the tent city that was in the park there. So there has been a couple of issues that have really drawn the ire of protesters who believe that Uptown's moving in a different direction, maybe towards gentrification.
Well, actually, what we're seeing is the city is now starting to make a transition to the way we are providing homeless services. And in this transition, it's kind of a bumpy time. So rather than focusing so much on measuring outputs, how many beds we provide, how many sandwiches we provide, how many people accept services, we're now starting to transition to how many people go from the streets into permanent housing within a set amount of time. So this is entailing all of us working together. And during that transition, people are upset because they don't understand the full picture of what the mayor and commissioner's doing.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, to be a Chicagoan for any length of time, more than a decade, you know Uptown, the fight that's been there, your predecessor, Alderman Schiller, fighting against the forces of gentrification in the area. So you can understand these have been long-standing issues in Uptown about whether or not there should be gentrification, whether or not some of the homeless shelters should be moved out. What I mean, do you see it that way? Do you see this has been, it feels like multiple decades fight in this neighborhood?
It's a fight on the entire north side. And what's happening on the entire north side, and again, it talks about city of Chicago being a tale of two cities, is that we're seeing a lot of gentrification occurring on the north side. We're having people with huge college debt who are paying $1,500 a month are now choosing to live in very small micro-unit apartments near the red line, and they are renting a lot of these apartments that people who were on the verge of homelessness once lived. And some of these residents that are concerned about gentrification were upset with me because they said I, as alderman, should have stopped the bank sale of some buildings that were in foreclosure. And no alderman can do that. No one can do that. But they don't understand that, and they're angry about the gentrification that's occurring. But at the same time, I believe that we as a city need to do everything we can to address affordable housing, because the key component to addressing homelessness is affordable housing. And I've reminded some of the people protesting, and I've reminded my colleagues that the Uptown community, we have some data that goes back to 2011, but it's not much changed since then, that the Uptown community ranks number one in the 77 community areas of having the most government-subsidized units. And on top of that, we get low-income housing trust fund units. That's rental subsidies to people who earn less than 30% of the area median income. We rank also number one there. And we receive more of those low-income housing trust fund subsidies than the combined total of 29 other wards. So we're doing our part. And within 5 blocks of my home, there are 6 homeless shelters. One is opening this month, a domestic violence shelter, which is very important because we only have 142 beds for people experiencing homelessness because of domestic violence. But we need other wards to step up on their plate, and they have not been doing
it. Now, I was going to ask that. I mean, do you find yourself, I mean, do you have to form a collective when it comes to affordable housing? Because ward by ward, you exactly what's happening in, you know, Wrigleyville, where people are getting pushed out because of, you know, rents are going too high, or Rogers Park, or I mean, you're always going to have sort of a push to another ward wherever there's affordable housing. So you almost have to approach this holistically, where a whole, you know, a collection of wards work together to deal with something like homelessness and affordable housing.
And that's what we, that's why we have the affordable requirements ordinance. And most Chicago residents don't quite understand it. They believe that an alderman can go to a landlord and say, you must provide affordable rents to this person. Alderman can't do that. It's against the law. The state of Illinois states doing that practice of rent controls is not allowed. So the Affordable Requirements Ordinance does provide incentives for developers to provide affordable rents. And I was on that task force to make more of that happen.
Alderman James Kappelman of the 46th Ward. We're talking about homelessness, affordable housing. We're going to take a quick break. We come back. We've got to bring Steve Dale in. I introduced him, and we haven't talked at all. But I want to talk about this, the big initiative that was at a big press conference today about the Chicago Proud. Hashtag yes. Chicago Proud. We'll talk about that when we come back here on The Download in 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. In studio with me, Steve Dale. Good to see you, Steve.
It is good to see you.
And Alderman James Kappelman. We're talking about Chicago Proud. This morning, a press conference, really, you know, as more and more negative stories come out about Chicago, and we see over and over this national storyline about how violent it is here and how Chicago has trouble, you know, this is your movement to really turn the tables and to emphasize the positive that's coming from the city.
But I don't want it to be my movement. I want it to be all 50 aldermen. I want it to be the mayor, but far more importantly, I want it to be broadcaster Justin Coffman. And far more important than that, everyone who lives in Chicago.
Yes.
Because every single day things happen that are great. You know, I'm from here and I'm sick and tired. Yes, housing is an issue. But you know what? Actually, that's an issue all over the country. Yes, the violence. You turn on the late night TV shows and you hear the stand-up comics making fun of our city because of a murder
right.
that happened. And too many of those that really do happen. And we do need to pay attention to that. At the same time, there is good happening every single day here. And no one seems to be paying attention to that. And whether it's the kid who got straight A's, whether it's the guy who helps a little old lady across the street, whether it's a major art exhibition opening at the Art Institute, or maybe at a neighborhood gallery in Uptown, or maybe in Pullman, or any neighborhood. That's the thing also. It's not about a single neighborhood. It's about our city. And we are proud of where we live. I don't think I'm alone in just talking to folks. So I did one of my rare fill-in stints, and I was just taking phone calls, and someone called from Milwaukee and said, oh, I love Chicago. Your food is great, and going on and on about how wonderful it is, but I can't come to Chicago anymore. And I said, why? Oh, I'm afraid. I can't even walk down Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And you know what? I am so tired of hearing that, and we need to promote the positives.
So how are you going to do that?
So all you have to do if you have a smartphone is walk around the city. Walk around your own house. When things happen that are good, big things like the Cubs winning the World Series, which, by the way, will happen, or a little thing like I described, but it's not so little to you, right, if your kid gets straight A's. No matter what it is, take a picture if you want. Whether it's Instagram, Facebook, or
Twitter, yeah,
right. Hashtag Chicago Proud.
Chicago Proud.
Yeah, so I went to a couple different folks. Some of the aldermen liked the idea. This alderman sitting to my right, Alderman James Kappelman, loved the idea, has been using that hashtag for a while.
Yes, for a long time.
So talk about it. I mean, what is it about this concept that belongs in the city councils? You talk about, you know, press conferences and proclamations. What is it about Steve's idea of Chicago Proud that got you involved?
Well, when I spoke about this with my colleagues, and colleagues from each ward is so uniquely different. And my colleagues from the South Side, West Side, all over the city, all in units, people who were African American, Latino, and in very wealthy wards and very in wards with lots of poverty, they all agreed that not enough is said about some of the positive things. And there were some wonderful things. And it was interesting, even speaking with some of the aldermen who say there is a lot of violence in their ward and a lot of terrible things are said, they get upset that we don't focus on some of the wonderful things that are happening.
You hear this all the time.
That lifts up the community to hear that, and that makes us want to continue working to improve our neighborhoods.
And whether it be Inglewood or Uptown, I mean, you hear this all the time, where there'll be a shooting in Uptown or a shooting in Inglewood, and everyone just says blankets
That's Inglewood. That's Uptown.
It's the worst ever. It's skyrocketing when that's not true. And here are the facts that, you know, you'll talk about the facts. But I think if we started becoming more positive, I think people, when they do hear news, they'll start maybe, let's look at a different perspective.
Well, there is a social concept, and there have been studies about the idea that if there's so much negativity turns into real negativity, so much social media negativity turns into real negativity and how we look at the world. I mean, this is sort of a way to not only showcase what Chicago does, but to change that rhetoric online and on the internet and other places where it's not just negative, that we can be positive in those spaces as well.
Well, there's a couple things about that. I agree. It's not a city ad campaign in that the public officials aren't creating an ad campaign. This is a city social media campaign conducted by people who live here every single day, looking at things and experiencing things that are terrific. And you know what? It could be plants in your garden, because it got a little warm outside. Plants in your garden saying, oh, I'm not giving up yet. Winter's not coming for a while. And you know what? We know through studies that those little things that happen, whether it be you walking, and I would know about this one, walking your dog down the street, and people can't help but smile. They can't. And then a happy dance happens in their head with the endorphins, and that's good for them. Well, they spread a little happiness to somebody else, you know? And it could be the flowers coming up. It can be anything at all that you are proud of at home where you live, on the block where you live, or in the community which you live. But it's all about the city in which we all live. This is the greatest city in the
absolutely,
country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Alderman, do you feel that the negativity that happens, that you hear the negative stories about Chicago on a national perspective, do you think that that actually has the impact or the possibility to have impact on tourism, on the city, on how people see Chicago from a global standpoint?
Absolutely. I mean, even my family have said, oh, my gosh, Chicago. It was scary to them. And yet there was a study that looked at the 25 most violent cities with populations over 200,000. And they looked at all 25, and Chicago wasn't even on the list, which stunned people. And that says something, that we just kind of feed on this negativity. I'm not saying that we should avoid some of these
issues. There are real issues. There are real
issues.
And
we need to
Chicago.
Tackle these
right.
issues,
right.
and they're serious. Right. But we also need to kind of balance them with some of the great things that are
so
happening.
So you went to the aldermen. They all enjoy it. What does that mean? When we say proclamation, when we say press conferences, what does it mean that the aldermen are all in on Chicago
crowd? It means
crowd?
There are going to be horns at City Hall that go, boom, 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 and all the aldermen stand up and say, we proclaim. Or did that happen thousands of years ago? I don't know if I'm describing that quite right, aldermen.
Well, it's interesting because when I talk to aldermen, and when I look at votes that happen, I'll look at, okay, is one group of aldermen saying yes on something, if it's like African-American, or is it just West Side, Latino? What's going on? But this was just across the table from all different backgrounds. They all agreed we need to be more positive.
That's well said. Yep. Steve Dale, Alderman James Kappelman in the 46th Ward. Really,
I have to ask, Justin.
Sure.
Is this the big table?
It's close to the big table. You guys are close.
I haven't graduated.
It is the big table. Yeah, you'll get close one of these days.
Darn it.
You keep doing your radio. Right?
I wanted to be at the big table.
Steve Dale, Alderman James Kappelman, the hashtag is Chicago Proud. Use it. I'm going to use it.
Thank you.
Good.
And thanks for being in the studio today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin.
Wow, this is a show, man. We keep going. Got to keep the energy up. Hasan Minhaj coming up. The Daily Show correspondent joins us. He's got a show at Dahlia Hall coming up on the 8th of October. We'll talk with him about that show, about the Daily Show, about politics, about doing a Daily Show in this campaign season. It's got to be tough for those guys. Also, the Ear Taxi Festival. Contemporary Music Festival is going to be at the Harris Theater and all over Chicago, including the University of Chicago's Rockefeller Chapel. That's starting tonight, right? Is tonight start? Yeah. So we'll talk with Augusta Reed Thomas coming up here after the news. So exciting. We're still going. I love it, man. It's exciting. Adrenaline. It's no picnic, but it's
keep
exciting.
Peddling. Yeah. Keep peddling.
Keep swimming. Just working keep
hard.
Swimming.
That's right. Right.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you may know my next guest is a correspondent for The Daily Show on Comedy Central. Hasan Minhaj is an actor and a comedian who just performed off-Broadway in his autobiographical solo show called Homecoming King, which is about his experiences as a first-generation Indian American. And he's bringing his stand-up show to Talia Hall for two performances on October 9th, one which is sold out already. Hasan Minhaj lives in New York City, and he's currently on tour, and he's taking a few minutes out to talk with us tonight. Hasan Minhaj, welcome to The Download. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man. I'm really excited to be on the show.
I'm interested in your background because, you know, just looking at your bio, you studied political science. How much does that help you studying political science in college, to being part of the Daily Show ensemble?
I didn't realize this at the time, but it was actually pretty helpful. It kind of informed just the way I thought about comedy. To me, the thing that drew me to stand up was it felt like funny speech and debate. And I know that sounds super nerdy, but it's like you're basically setting up these, like, I did forensics in high school, and you're basically setting up these like little arguments in real time. And then when you're riffing, you're kind of doing impromptu speaking. So it's like it was the hybrid of the two. And what's interesting is that when I joined The Daily Show, one of the things that John kept talking about was like, what's our take? What's our take? It's not that we're reporting the news. It's we're providing a specific take or argument. And having the best take is what won in the writer's room. And so it inadvertently did help in a weird way.
The Daily Show's always been is an anomaly in the way that it's not unlike a comedy show that you'll see on television, but also a newsroom or a news show that you'll see on television. The way it works behind the scenes, talk about that, the idea that it does very much mirror a news shop, essentially like a newspaper or a television broadcast news shop.
I would say between the hours of like 9 and 10, it does, in the sense that when we're breaking story in the morning, we kind of see all the stuff that's coming in and how the media and how people are reacting to it. Then after that, it's kind of like a satirical joke factory where it's like, okay, well, you know, let's take, for example, what the big thing that's happening this week is like Trump's tax returns have been leaked. And so it's like, oh, wow. Like basically he hasn't been paying taxes ostensibly for quite a bit of time because he was losing. And so Trump is winning for being a loser. So it's like, what's the sort of satirical take that we can have there? Is that, and then we just sort of break it down from there. And that's always the fun part. And we build basically between 9 and 6:30 when we tape, we build these sandcastles and then we do it again the next day, which is, I think, a really, really unique thing.
Well, there's definitely a lot of energy and frenetic pace because you have to respond to the news on any given day. Talk about that. I mean, you as a stand-up comedian and someone who's come from the sketch comedy world but also doing web series, when getting into that practice, the practice of responding to the news in a satirical way immediately, how did you have to evolve? How did you have to develop as a comedian to do that?
It's crazy because it feels like you're sprinting through a marathon, like where you kind of have – you have to have a long lens on like, hey, this is what are we like, what is the bigger picture of all this stuff, whether it's the presidential election or it's the debates or it's a specific topic like the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan, having a long lens on it, but then also having like a very specific sprint sort of mentality where it's like, all right, we're focusing specifically on this Joe Biden gaffe. We're focusing specifically on, you know, Donald Trump's mic cutting out or him coughing or drinking water all the time during the debate. It's like, it's both of those. It's being aware of both of those things, which is something I've had to learn in my 2 years on the show.
Hasan Minhaj is a stand-up comedian, and he's also a correspondent for The Daily Show. We're talking to him. He's got two shows at Talia Hall coming up here on October 9th. The other thing, I was just reading an article that mentioned advice that Jon Stewart gave you when you started. He said, move towards your discomfort. What does that mean?
Yeah, if there's just it took me a while to figure that out because John is kind of like Jewish Yoda, where you kind of have to make sense of these like nuggets of wisdom. But it basically was like, look, what are the things that people are just like too uncomfortable to talk about because it's too complicated or perhaps there's too many layers to it? And then start to move towards that. Start writing towards that. Not in the sense of like we're trying to offend people. It's like, no, let's try to unbox these things that people push aside in the attics of their own minds and slowly try to break it down. And that's what I think fascinated me the most about this whole Colin Kaepernick situation. I think for the first time, race relations was being brought to, you know, our Sunday mm-hmm. ritual of wine and circus. And people, whether you liked it or not, millions and millions of people that weren't being exposed to this through their news feed or whatever echo chamber they were surrounding themselves with, this was being brought to the forefront, and they're just, and it was really uncomfortable for people to go, hey, man, I'm just trying to drink Bud Light and watch the game and watch men potentially get brain injuries that will affect them for the rest of their life. Don't remind me about what's happening the other six days
right.
of the week.
Right.
You know, and I think the Daily Show has taught me to go, no, the fact that there is this real visceral reaction to this news story with this specific case study means we should talk about it. Now, let's unbox it one layer at a time, from the tweets to the outrage to people saying he should do it, people he shouldn't do it, and provide our take or perspective on it and what this means in a larger sense.
And obviously, I mean, with the election we're having right now in 2016, you think about the idea of where the Daily Show has just been so strong over the years. And it, you know, I think back to even before your time and George W. Bush and the takedown power, truth to power that Jon Stewart did so well. When you are writing comedy, especially political comedy, in a situation where you have a presidential candidate like Donald Trump who seems to trip over his own, you know, his own shoelaces constantly over and over and over, does it make it harder to be able to drive home a point or drive home a message when that message seems to be pervasive everywhere?
I guess yes and no. It's interesting. The landscape, there's so many different shows now that are providing their takes or insight. I think the unique advantage that we have is that we get to do it every day. So a lot of other shows like do it weekly, or maybe put politics isn't their sort of their end game. This is interesting where we get to build this over the course of the year. You know, we do 200 plus some odd episodes a year. So it's a lot. And so I still think that what we do is still important. And the way, you know, the fact that Trevor helms it from his perspective, that's what makes it unique and special.
Hassan, you had your own show, Homecoming King, which is on Off-Broadway last year. How much of that story, which is really your story about your experiences as a first-generation Indian-American, how much of that gets into your stand-up? How much of it shows up in The Daily Show? How much does it show up in other places outside of the Off-Broadway stage?
You know, on The Daily Show, just like kind of like SNL, I'm an ensemble player in an ensemble cast where I come in and I bring my perspective and takes and pitches and I provide it to the show. But at the same time, we are confined to roughly 7.5 minute acts. Mm-hmm. You know, we're a 22 to 23 minute show, and I'm a correspondent on that. Just like you'll see your favorite sketch player on SNL, they'll be able to contribute. This is a longer form thing. It's, you know, it's 75 minutes, and it's like a theatrical play where there's four acts, and I get to go on these longer journeys. What's interesting is that topical news sort of ages like bread. It's really fun, and it's great to eat. I love bread. Shout out to the Cheesecake Factory. Brown bread is amazing. It's amazing, but it doesn't have, you know, whether we like it or not, come January 20th, 50% of the presidential material we are doing will be virtually irrelevant. That's why political news kind of ages like bread. To me, the reason why I wanted to take a show to the theater and have it be stories about my life and then extrapolate those true stories to talk about xenophobia or racism or forgiveness or race relations in America, or what does it mean? What is the American dream, and what is the current stamp that New Brown America is putting on it? The reason why I want to provide my own narrative to it is because there is a timelessness to it. This story has been told before, but it's also new, and the variables that are shaping it through my life growing up in the States here over the past 30 years are new, and I kind of wanted to add my chapter to that. So it's both like new, but it's also universal, and having a piece of art to live like that, that's really like, man, as an artist, it's really awesome. That's what we want to do. You know, we want things that'll sort of last longer right. than Trump jokes, you know?
Well, I think, I mean, we've talked about this on the show before, you know, when you think about people, brown comedians, maybe South Asian comedians. There isn't a generation before them of people making jokes on stage or even in the theater or otherwise that people can look up to them and say, oh, yeah, this is great. I want to do this. For you, I mean, you and others in your generation, you are becoming that person for a younger person of an Indian American background to say, I can do this work. I can be on The Daily Show. I can be a stand-up comedian and so forth.
Yeah, I was telling this to my dad, which is really interesting. My dad was an immigrant to this country, and all things considered, my generation, I'm talking about people like me, Kumail Nanjiani, Aziz Ansari, Russell Peters, Mindy Kaling, we're immigrants to Hollywood.
Right.
And what I derive inspiration from are the great, you know, Jewish satirists that came before me, the great African-American satirists that came before me, that basically paved their way and added their narrative to the American comedic story. And I think that's something really exciting that our generation is getting to see in real time.
What's next for you? I mean, obviously you're on tour with the stand-up. You're coming to Talia Hall here. You got two shows, one already sold out. Do you stay with the Daily Show, but you obviously can do other things? Are you looking for more opportunities in television and film, or are you comfortable with your work on the stage?
I really love what I'm doing right now, man, with the Daily Show, which is awesome. It's like I get to do stuff that's like funny and meaningful, which is a lot of times, man, and you know this in this business, it's mutually exclusive. It's usually like, oh, I'm on this thing that's really funny, but you know, I'm in The Hangover 5. Like, I don't know how quote unquote meaningful it is, or it's, you know, something that's really, really, really like super meaningful, but it's like, oh man, this 60 minute report I did on Aleppo is pretty depressed. You know, it's like, it's one or the other. Daily Show's really awesome where it's the intersection of the two. I think also, you know, it's been cool that it's also given me the opportunity I've to go do other things. You know, Daily Show is a great sort of breeding ground that has allowed a lot of talented people to go jump off and do other things. I just did this movie called Rock That Body with Scarlett Johansson and Jillian Bell and a lot of really, really funny, talented people that comes out next year. I'm really excited about that. We just wrapped on that. And then, you know, I'm touring the show, and then I have a really, really special surprise for everybody at the end of the tour. But this is sort of our last hurrah. Like, this is your chance to come see it live. And I really think, man, just the live experience of seeing a show like this. I know a lot of comedians do one-man shows that are these narrative arcs in Europe, but it's not really...
Yeah, it's not, right.
Here in the States.
Are you worried that people come out to the show and say, oh, this is not my traditional stand-up show? That I was going to get myself a gin and tonic and watch a bunch of airport jokes?
Yeah. you know, it's funny. People are like, this isn't what I expected. I was like, oh, dude, I'm sorry I let you down. They're like, no, it's better. It actually, like, had meaning. Like, I just thought you were going to, like, I thought you were just going to do a bunch of, like, random mixtape, you know, like a grab bag of jokes.
Right, right.
You know? Sex, relationships, a little bit of politics, a little bit of, like, what my life is like, and then good night. This is sort of, like, built around these set acts and thesis statements, and so it's cool, man. That's what I really love doing, and I see myself doing more shows like that in the future.
There you go. Hasan Minhaj, he's a correspondent for The Daily Show. He's going to be at Talia Hall on October 9th for two shows, one of which is already sold out. Hasan, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us now. We appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Well, it's official. The San Francisco Giants beat the New York Mets in New York. They'll be coming to Chicago on Friday. The New York Mets. Good. The San Francisco Giants? I predict a Cubs sweep. Madison Bumgarner tonight pitched a complete game shutout of the New York Mets. I saw something on Twitter that says he has a scoreless streak of something like 20-some-odd innings in playoff baseball. Madison Bumgarner will not be able to pitch probably game three. So we're only going to see Madison Bumgarner one time in this five-game series, right?
I mean, I guess he would probably come back in game five to pitch, you know, I think that one series, when one of those World Series, he pitched last four innings or something of a game.
Well, I mean, hey, let's excise the ghosts of 1989. There's no Will Clark. No Hunter Pence. Hunter Pence is no Will Clark, right?
God, I hate that guy.
I know.
It's going to really...
Will Clark or Hunter Pence?
Will Clark's fine, but Hunter Pence, I hated that guy when he was on the Cardinals.
Look.
I just, you know, I hate him on
the
Astros.
Cardinals? He's the Astros. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So this series will really amp up my hatred of Hunter Pence.
Well, you know who'd be a good guy? A guy I used to work with, Chris Hagan. He works in Chicago. He lived in San Francisco, and he's a guy who's got the San Francisco Giants hat, you know, and he's just super into it. And I remember sitting by him when I was working at a different place, and while the Giants won the World Series a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows the team so well. I mean, I should probably hit him up and see what's up, just to see if this Giants team is any good. Because I look at it and I'm like, it's a bunch of long hairs. You got the Pence. I don't know what that look is. Brandon Crawford. Nah. Angel Pagan's on the show. Angel Pagan.
Former Cub.
Yeah. Brandon Belt. What? Joe Panic. Does he even play on this team? Eduardo Nunez is on this team.
Yeah.
Buster Posey.
When you look at the lineup, it's not good. It's not as intimidating. But, you know, they
know how to win these games.
They win, you know. Yeah. And, you know, every even number year since 2010, they win the World Series.
Well, I'm excited because I'm a big fan of this, you know, like a team of destiny. When you have a team of destiny, you got to go through and beat the teams.
Sure.
You got to go through and beat them. You know, you got to go. And for me, I think it's even more special if the Cubs can beat and really, you know, pulverize the San Francisco Giants to pay back the 89 demons of those teams, which was Will Clark and who else? Was Kevin Mitchell on that team?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Who was on that Giants team? Was it Robbie Thompson? Wasn't Robbie Thompson a guy? Who? And then Matt Williams played third base? Am I mixing up my decades? I feel like that was that team, but I could be wrong, too.
Yeah. Was Bob Brenly on that team? I think Bob Brenly might have been on that team, actually.
I feel like there were maybe there was a Hostetler on that team. Maybe a Dave Rigetti wrapping up his career.
Yeah, right. Dave Rigetti. Isn't he still a pitching coach for the Giants?
Is he for the Giants? So, yeah. So the series is set Friday night, 8:15 at Wrigley Field. The Giants and the Cubs. Ooh. I love it, man. As an outsider, I'm a Sox fan, but as an outsider, I like that matchup.
You do, yeah.
I'm not at all intimidated by Jeff Samardzija as a White Sox fan. That's the last guy I'd want, Jeff Samardzija and Jake Peavy, anywhere near playoff baseball.
Well, what's going to happen with the Cubs, and you kind of alluded to this the other day, is that, you know, you're confident, you like this team. Got Cueto pitching that first game.
Cueto's tough.
He wins that game. Cubs lose the first game at home. Then the pressure starts to mount. Then you're thinking in the back of your mind, oh, my God, we got to win the second game. Because then we got Bumgarner coming against us on Monday in San Francisco.
That's Cub fans, man. Robbed you hear Pete's frustration is weird. Here we go.
I know. Let the hand-wringing begin. Yeah. You know what's going to be fun is that, you know, clearly we'll be on. Uh-huh. Okay. Game one.
Yep.
But I will be closely monitoring, more so than I usually do, Twitter. So anytime that I get a funny little tweet or Cubs fans are starting to go over the edge, even though it's game one, I'll definitely work it into my update.
It's breaking news. Yeah. Yeah. They're this developing.
Especially if it comes from one Pete Zim.
Right.
You know?
At Pete Zim, Cubs fan 44, says, here we go. End of days.
It begins.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. This week, a new music festival born in Chicago. It's called the Ear Taxi Festival, and its mission is to put emerging and established classical and contemporary musicians front and center. The festival will feature 88 composers and over 350 musicians, 54 world premieres, over 6 days of performances. It'll happen at several venues around Chicago, including the Harris Theater in Millennium Park. It's being put on by one of Chicago's greatest composers, Augusta Reed Thomas. Augusta is a Grammy-winning composer who spent a decade or so as a composer in residence at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and is currently a professor of composition at the University of Chicago. And joining Augusta is one of the composers from the festival, Joey Brink. Joey's instrument of choice is the carillon, and he is the University Carillon Ewer at the University of Chicago. Augusta, Joey, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Justin, for having us.
Augusta, let me start with you. The Ear Taxi Festival, talk about the work that goes into this. I read somewhere it took years for you to put this together. Talk about why this festival is born here in Chicago.
Oh, thanks for asking. There's a wonderful scene for contemporary classical art music that exists in Chicago. And for really a decade, all these groups have been playing this music, tons of composers. It's very vibrant, diverse. You have music of all kinds that's being played all around the city. And about 3 years ago, I was walking through Millennium Park and I thought, Gusty, you should put together this huge festival. And then I thought, shoot yourself in the head right now, you know, because this is too much work. But I thought, you know, this really should happen. And if there's some leadership and some vision, one can put together an amazing festival, which actually somebody today, one of our musicians, was referring to it as new music's coming out party, as it were, because it's all happening and it's been happening.
You know, for people who are into music and maybe not familiar with the contemporary scene here, when you say that, you know, that it's booming in Chicago, there's so many different acts that are playing. Take us through that. How is that happening? What is it about the bones of the contemporary music scene here that make this the epicenter?
I would even say, Justin, that the Chicago new music scene for contemporary classical music is the best in the country. That's how strongly I feel about it. We have groups like Third Coast Percussion that are touring the world, Spectral Quartet, Phenoma Consort, Fulcrum Point New Music Project. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes on and on. Ensemble Del Niente and lots more. I could go on and on. These people are touring, recording, winning Grammys, and doing amazing work. And the vibrancy of the composers working here. And I think also one of the things about the culture here is that people collaborate, right, and it's positive. And there are leaders in town that are constantly, you know, keeping us all working together. And it's not competitive where, oh, I don't like those people, I don't like these people, or we don't like that music, and we don't like that music, that it's campy. It's not like that. And I think one of the things that brings the possibility for a festival like Ear Taxi to bubble up from the grassroots, which I'll speak a tiny bit about in a second, is the whole culture. For instance, if you think about John Van Ryan of the Chicago Tribune, mm-hmm, or Wynn Delacoma, the Sun-Times, the late Andrew Patner, and many others, these people have been writing about contemporary,
yeah, right,
class. Yeah, for 30
each
years.
Each paper, yeah, you're right. Each paper has a section that's on contemporary classical. What is it about Chicago? I think about the universities, you know, where you're at, University of Chicago, and also Northwestern, which you taught at before. What is it? Does a good contemporary classical scene have to have university presence? What is it that makes a good contemporary classical scene?
Well, I think the great universities of our city are amazing on a world-class level. But I think one of the things that's important is that there's an openness and a curiosity and a spirit for experimentation and people supporting each other. If you go to one concert, you see a whole group of people, and then those group maybe goes to the other group as well. In other words, it's not campy. And I think that kind of collaboration and people writing for each other and making work together is very, very real and vivid here. And therefore, there's a sense of camaraderie, which makes a festival like Ear Taxi possible. Because one of my visions for this was to be very inclusive. And I also didn't want any of the concerts to overlap, which was a feat, as you can imagine. Right. Because I wanted each person to have their moment and not say, oh, will you come to my concert? Oh, no, I can't come to yours because I'm going to the other one. I wanted to have it be that you could go to everything if you wanted, and each of the groups can come and support one another, because that's part of the spirit and the culture that's here.
I want to get to Joey in just a second. We're going to talk at length about the Carillon, but I'm interested in this scene and continuing to talk about what makes it tick and what brings musicians, composers to Chicago. Why don't we talk about your story? You're a Grammy Award winner. You had a residency as a composer in residence at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, but you're not from Chicago. Talk about how you got here.
Yeah, I'm from New York, and actually the first moment that I arrived here, I arrived at Northwestern as a trumpet performance major, and my goal in life was to be a trumpet player in the Chicago Symphony, and I'd played piano my whole life and sung in choirs and all this, but I was very advanced at trumpet. Of course, I was composing all along as well, and I fell in love with the city, and that was a long time ago. I'm getting to be like this ancient old lady, but I've been here since 1983 and really consider Chicago absolutely my home, and I feel it's important to give back. I've been so fortunate with all kinds of opportunities worldwide. And I think it's important to stand up and say, this is important music. These are incredible people making this music. They work so hard. For instance, you have a composer that might work for 8 months on a piece. Then you have these musicians that are going to have 6 rehearsals, literally, to learn all these pieces. Then they come onto the Harris stage and play on Ear Taxi. The amount of human time and training and expertise and rehearsal, if you add all of that up with the 350 musicians and the 88 composers and the 54 world premieres, just the sheer human energy that this festival is displaying is really a beautiful group story and a beautiful city story.
When you came here in 1983, did you jump right into a contemporary classical scene? I mean, what was music like here when it comes to classical music and specifically new classical? What was it like in the early to mid-80s?
You know, Justin, that's a really good question because it was so different. There was a group around town named Cube. They were wonderful people, right. Salt of the Earth, these amazing artists and people that had a sort of a small series. And there wasn't a huge amount of other things. Now it's completely different. At the Chicago Symphony, the Music Now series is thriving. And actually, I founded that as well.
Is it because of people like you forging the way? And how much of it is it about universities and institutions being more accepting of the music and saying, oh, this is interesting. Let's try some new projects. Let's try some things. Let's expand to make a scene.
I think that it's a little of both. I mean, Chicago for me is like a yes city. If you come in and say, like, I have this huge dream, I have no money, I'm going to make this huge festival and I'm going to get all these contemporary artists and we're going to do this amazing thing with 54 world premieres. People are like, yeah,
sure,
okay.
Why not?
Let's do that.
Make
okay.
No small plans.
And one of the things I tried to do was to reach all across the city to working with Harris Theater, the Department of Cultural Affairs, many funders, the Driehaus Foundation, the Cheney Foundation, the Mead Foundation, and of course, the Chicago Symphony, Civic Orchestra, Pianoforte, the People's Music School. I mean, everybody, 25 yeah. ensembles. Really, everybody has come together around this particular one-time-only festival. So anybody who wants to come to Ear Taxi, this is your... It's not happening again. It's just a one-off,
wow, one-off
festival.
All right. Raising the stakes here. Composer Augusta Reed Thomas and Carolina Joey Brink, who we're going to get to in just a second. The Ear Taxi Festival is on now, happening at venues all around Chicago, including the Harris Theater in Millennium Park. Let's take a quick break, and we'll get Joey involved in the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Patty Vasquez coming up at 11 o'clock tonight, but we continue our conversation with the Ear Taxi Festival. It's going on through Sunday. Joey Brink, he is the University Carillon Ewer at the University of Chicago. He plays the Carillon. First off, I know what the Carillon is because, you know, there's not too many, and it's but explain to WGN Radio what a Carillon is.
Yeah, a Carillon is a pretty unusual instrument. It exists in a bell tower. It is a bell tower. And it's a collection of bells played from a mechanical action, kind of like a piano. And at University of Chicago, we have the second largest carillon in the world. It has 72 bells in total, weighing 100 tons of bronze. And we can play very softly on the instrument or very loud. We have a lot of control of our expression on the instrument.
It's amazing, too, at the Rockefeller Chapel at the University of Chicago. But, I mean, talk about how you get into being a carillon. I would assume that's a very specific kind of a musician because there's not a lot of carillons to play in the world.
Right. There are about 600 carillons in the world, about 180 in North America. I didn't grow up expecting to become a carilloner. I had no idea what a carillon was until I was 18, and I arrived in college at Yale University and joined a club of students that would play the bells every day for campus.
Really?
Totally fell in love with it, yeah. And it's become my passion, and I'm really excited to make this my life's work.
Now, obviously, you're not going to be taking the carillon and taking it to Harris Theater, Millennium Park. It's not moving.
Right.
But you will be performing as part of the festival. Talk about, you know, being a part of this scene, being a university carilloner. Talk about how you fit in with other composers and classical musicians who are playing new music.
Yeah, thank you. So I've been in Chicago for only about a year, so I'm pretty new to Chicago. And it's exciting to be part of this scene really just immediately upon moving to Chicago. So I'm super grateful and just excited about that. But even more than that, it's pretty unheard of for the carillon as an instrument to be included in a music festival, let alone a new music festival. Mm-hmm. The instrument was born in the Low Countries of Europe as a medieval timekeeping instrument, a method for announcing different happenings in the cities that the bell towers were centralized in. And so thinking of the carillon as a concert instrument is only new in the last 50, 60 years. And thinking of it as a contemporary instrument that can be included in a new music festival is kind of groundbreaking. And it's just really, really cool that Gusty has drawn up the idea to include the carillon in a festival of new music.
I love the idea of people coming and sitting out on the grass at beautiful Rockefeller Chapel and hearing all these world premiere sounds flying out of the carillon. And two things I wanted to say. First of all, Joey has gone really the extra mile because he has actually made a recording of what he's playing on Ear Taxi Festival, which, as you know, is incredibly difficult because you need to have microphones all over right. you, microphones outside. You have to take care of the wind handling. Well, what about the birds and the cicadas? And maybe you can talk a little bit about what it means. It's not that easy to just record a carillon. If it rains, the recording date is off. If there's a truck that goes by, you have to restart your take.
Yeah, so it's been a pretty fun summer, and I can't really take the credit for this. Our recording engineer, Christopher Willis, has been great on this project and so much fun to work with. But the way this process has worked, we set maybe 9 or 10 recording dates that were actually successful to record. There were several other dates in our list of possible recording sessions that we had to scrap due to weather or construction planning in the area. Some of the sessions we actually did record, but then had to scrap all of the recordings because there was just too much background noise. But essentially, the process was me up in the tower, Chris on the ground, both with a walkie-talkie. I would start playing. Maybe 5 or 10 seconds later, Chris would interrupt saying, "You got a plane, there's a bus, somebody's walking by. We got to start again." And so I'm not exaggerating. It would take us up to 2 hours to record 5 minutes of music. And so there were definitely some frustrating moments for both of us, but overall it was a lot of fun. We're both really happy with how it turned out and both excited to work together again in the future.
So this performance will be on Thursday the 6th,
that's
correct?
Right.
And that's how it's going to play out. People sit at the base of the Rockefeller Chapel of the carillon and listen to your performance. And I'm interested, when you talk about it being a contemporary composition, I mean, when you, as a carillon, I mean, I would assume that there's a lot of traditional elements that go with the carillon because of its roots. We talked about being a medieval, almost, I don't even know what you would call it, like a barker, if you will, like today's garbage day, right? That's the concept.
Right.
But talk about how you contemporize it. I mean, are you pushing the instrument to places it hasn't been before, or do you consider the traditional roots and play within the construct of the traditional?
Well, I don't want to take too much credit. I think caroloners over the last 50, 60 years have done an excellent job in turning the carillon into a concert instrument, whereas in the past it has been more of a signaling instrument in cities. But this effort is really ongoing, and celebrating the coming of the carillon as a concert instrument at Ear Taxi is really exciting.
One of the things I love about Joey's concert is the titles, and in particular, one of the works that he wrote, which has its world premiere on Ear Taxi Festival, is called Letters from the Sky. And that is just so beautiful. Letters from the Sky. When I read that, I thought, and didn't you title your new CD Letters from the Sky?
That's right. Yeah, that's the album title.
All right, last question for Joey. I'm curious as I think about this. I'm like, how do you practice?
That's really good question. It's
like, I mean, is it like you do it at certain hours when everyone's like, oh, Joey's up there again. I can hear the whole South Side can hear it.
Yeah, so instead of actually practicing on the real carillon, we instead practice on separate instruments called practice carillons.
Okay.
And they're identical keyboards at Rockefeller. They're in the basement or the catacombs of the chapel. And they're electronic, so we can play for only ourselves without everybody hearing. That being said, it's not an ideal practice experience. The real carillon has a wide variety of dynamics in terms of the weight of the keys and the inertia of the clappers that move and strike the bells. And so the feel of the keyboard, like moving from a digital piano to a to a Steinway piano is very different. And so it's not the perfect practice experience, right, but it still allows us to learn our notes and get ready to go up and play the big bells.
University Carol Neuer at the University of Chicago. Joey Brink, he will be featured at Ear Taxi, the Chicago Festival of New Music, which runs through the weekend. Augusta Reed Thomas, the Grammy-winning composer, former composer in residence at Chicago Symphony Orchestra, currently a professor of composition at the University of Chicago. This is your baby. You put this together, the Ear Taxi. My last question is just the concept of new music or even contemporary classical. In a weird way, it's the kind of music that hasn't had a breakthrough to a mainstream audience that, and a lot of times people say, I don't know anything about that, so it scares me or I'm intimidated about how to listen. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the art form itself. How do those people come out and enjoy this festival?
Well, Ear Taxi Festival is really kaleidoscopic. First of all, the ticket prices are very low. More than half of the concerts are free. So you can just come and engage with this festival. And the way it's put together, if you come, let's say, for a given night, you're going to hear one group, let's say a string quartet, play a world premiere by one composer, maybe 7 minutes. Then some other group will walk out on stage, maybe a septet, and they're going to play another world premiere by another composer. And then another one and another one. So it's very kaleidoscopic and fast moving. You can come in blue jeans, t-shirts, cutoff shorts. It's very casual. You can buy a beer or a glass of wine or whatever else you would like. And at Harris, they let you bring it in. So you can literally bring your drink in and listen to all of these different sound worlds. And I think it's very, very interesting. What are the syntaxes? What are the languages? And so one piece will be ritualistic and another piece might be dreamy and another piece might be pointillistic and so on and so forth. And one thing I was thinking, Justin, is if the poets of Chicago decided that they would all get together and they'd all write a world premiere poem and then they would read them and that would be a festival, I would buy that festival pass immediately, because I would think, what are they talking about? What is their syntax? What is the diversity of their rhythmic syntax? What is their body language like as they're reading or sort of speaking their poems? What are the subject matters? And Ear Taxi's almost the same. It's just in sound. And I think the diversity is wonderful. And also, all the artists live in Chicago. So if you come to Ear Taxi and you hear a piece you like, you can just go up to the composer and say, can I buy you a beer? Can I take you out next week? Or go backstage and talk to the artist and say, I'm coming to your next show, or how can I help your group? So I'm really hoping that the effort of all of our putting together of Ear Taxi with all these 500 people involved in terms of musicians and composers will have ripple effects. People will say, oh, I'd love to commission that composer. I didn't know I could commission a piece, or I'd love to go to their next show. Or, you know, people, once you start to realize who the people are making the music and you can come and engage in short pieces, it's not like going to a symphonic concert where you sit for a 50-minute piece and you can't move. It's very, very kaleidoscopic.
Augusta Reed Thomas, the great composer here in Chicago. She's the professor of composition at the University of Chicago. Her one-time only festival.
Otherwise, I'll be dead.
Ear Taxi, the Chicago Festival of New Music. It's on through the weekend. Also, Joey Brink, who is the University Carol Neuer at the University of Chicago. Joey, Augusta, thanks so much for coming in and talking about the music.
Thank you so much, Justin. I've always admired your show, and I'm just so happy that I'm on your show. Can I say something?
Sure, sure.
Because
yeah.
I always wanted to do this.
Yeah, thank you, Justin. This is really cool.
What was it that Robin Williams used to say? Good morning, Vietnam?
Yeah.
Good morning, Chicago!
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNradio.com. Patty Vasquez coming up next. Tomorrow night on the program, Eric Schlosser, the author of Fast Food Nation and Command and Control. There's a new documentary for his that's based on his book, Command and Control, which is going to be at the Siskel Center. So we'll talk with Eric. Also, this one's awesome. Thomas Jones, former running back for the Chicago Bears, who brought us to the Super Bowl 10 years ago, who now goes by the name of Thomas Q. Jones because he's an actor in Hollywood. He's in the new Netflix show, Luke Cage. Sorry about that. How great is that? How cool is that?
Tommy Q.
So how cool is that? So we'll talk with him tomorrow on the program. Yeah, that's kind of like a dream come true. Not only are you successful running back, but then you're just like, yeah, I'll try something new. I'll be in the new Marvel superhero show. Yeah, why not? I'm blessed. I'm talking about that.